recording?
Hi, everybody. Yes, we're live. Are you recording?
Yes, I'm recording.
That's a good, important first question there. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I am. I have verified I am recording, and I am also doing my backup recording, as has been discussed numerous times. So, hey, I just got back from Tennessee. Howdy, y'all.
Sweet. Are you going to say that now? Like, that's, you know how, like, you ever know those people in your life that, like, they go to, you know, say England or something, like some country that is not your country. They go to that country.
They're there, mate.
For like 2 weeks or 1 week, and then they come back and they have kind of a half accent like forever after that point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know.
Yes, I got on. I got to tell you, the lift at the hotel was extremely slow. I was very sad about it. No, I went to Memphis.
John.
I know.
Did they say howdy in Tennessee? Is that a howdy state?
I don't even know, to be honest.
It's definitely
Texas
a y'all
seems
state.
Like a howdy state.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in a y'all state, so who am I to really throw stones on that issue? So
honestly, I kind of wish I was in a y'all state because
it's the best.
Like the second person plural is extremely useful, and the rest of English doesn't really. You know, we just have you and you.
I think y'all is spreading. I think I need to see a y'all map. I think it's spreading. I don't think it's South only anymore. I hear it a lot around here. I used it myself a lot at work. I heard it a lot at work in my jobby jobs. Yeah.
I cannot,
like, unironically,
fathom.
Not trying to do, yeah, like, yeah, yeah. I think it is, it's not common, but I think it's spreading. That's my
man,
theory.
I am here for you, Mr. John Syracuse, saying y'all, like, that
I'm sure I have said it on the show, and I bet you two didn't even bat an eye at it, because
well, I certainly wouldn't,
so used to hearing it, like, I didn't say it with a Southern accent, I just, you
not
know.
Fair.
I think you're required.
Anyway,
to
we're,
say
get, we're already
a little
getting
a Southern accent, though. Like when you like, I feel like, I mean, for the service it provides is wonderful, and I thank the South for this because, like, you know, as we have become a little bit more, you know, aware of inclusion and things that, you know, trying to get rid of gendered phrases like guys, you know, to refer to just general people, hey guys, you know, like we're trying to drop that and replace it with something more neutral. And you see, like, what options exist in the language, and there's not a lot of good options out there. You know, there's. Like some politicians have used, like, folks, you know, hey, folks.
Yeah, like, I like that one. I use that one myself, too. I think it's great.
I don't like that one so much.
It's very folksy.
And that's fine sometimes, but that's not always appropriate. But I feel like if you're in a y'all region, y'all is pretty much always usable. Like, there's not really any context in which it would feel weird or impart any additional meaning that you wouldn't intend the way folks kind of does. So I feel like y'all is a far superior
what unintended
word.
Meaning does folks imply?
Yeah.
It's kind of folksy.
No, it's fine. It just means people. It's just a shorter version for people. I don't think there's anything implied about folks.
Yeah, I think you're reading a little too much into that. In fact, if anything, and I'm a staunch defender of y'all, but I think y'all reads more or sounds more folksy than folks, if I were to make an argument. But nevertheless, here we are. So yeah, so I went to Memphis. I got to tell you, there's clearly no motor vehicle safety inspection in Tennessee because every darn car that I was in or near had a shattered windshield. But be that as it may, it was very nice. I had a very good time. I went and I saw our mutual friends, Stephen Hackett, who of course lives in Memphis, but was also hosting in more ways than one, which we'll get to in a second. I saw Jason Snell, Kathy Campbell, a couple of the Discord mods, Micah Sargent, so many people that I saw. And it was so great to see them because I hadn't seen any of them since 2019. And so now I've been whittling down the list of people I haven't seen. You know, Marco and I saw each other in November, I believe it was. And then Mike, I saw in March, if I'm not mistaken. Now I've seen this group. Still haven't seen John.
Mm-hmm. Looking right at John.
Looking right at permanence. You. Even when you don't see me, I still exist.
In any case, I was down in Memphis because it is not September. However, we are getting prepped for September because if you are a long time or even a mildly long time ATP listener, you'll know that September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. And we spend a lot of time and energy raising money for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. So St. Jude was doing their PlayLive Plus Creators Summit. Which I guess was born from a video game only crowd in, you know, like Twitch streamers and whatnot. And they would come in every year. I guess they've been doing this for a handful of years, and they would come in and, you know, learn about St. Jude if they'd never been there and, you know, talk to other creators about how, you know, you can be more effective at raising money for St. Jude and so on and so forth. And it was really lovely, but it was very, very weird because I'm used to being an outcast for being a total dork. But in this case, I was an outcast because I wasn't the right kind of dork because everyone around me.
I don't know. See, I was going to say, like, so this is a thing where they would get together with, like, Twitch streamers and stuff. And it sounds like this year they decided to expand it out into much less cool dorks.
Correct. That is true.
Podcasters are welcome now.
Well, no. It was actually both less cool and more cool dorks because there were definitely some, like, fashion influencers and whatnot. cooler, definitely cooler. Fitness, I couldn't think of the word for a second there. Fitness people, cooler. Then the gamer people, who were kind of de facto cool because there were so many of them. And then me. And Dark
Cloud. And some podcasters. That's cool.
Yeah, and then a handful of podcasters. But it was very nice. Like, nobody made me feel like an outsider deliberately, but it's funny because everyone kind of traded on, you know, what do you stream, as in what video games do you stream? And that, I had no good answer for that. And it's, again, nobody was trying to be rude or unkind or anything like that, or dismissive. It's just, you know, that's what they were used to. But anyway.
So what did you say when they said, what do you stream? What did you say?
I actually don't. I am actually a podcaster, and, you know, I'm part of a group that raises
and
a whole pile of money.
Away.
They're like, oh, pretty what's your much, YouTube
yeah.
channel?
Yeah, right. Exactly. No, not quite that bad, but that's a fair guess. But yeah, so we went and we learned a little more about St. Jude, and I got to take a tour of the campus. And let me tell you, I know that I think I speak for all three of us, but I certainly speak for myself in saying I was pretty in the bag for St. Jude anyway, even before this trip, and holy crap-a-moly, I am so in the bag for St. Jude right now. It's ridiculous because the stuff these people do is incredible. And I mean, admittedly, you know, this is a conference or whatever put on by St. Jude to make you excited about St. Jude. So, you know, I am considering the source. However, they brought up several different people, both employees and patients and everyone in between, that said some flavor of the story of, yeah, either myself or my spouse or, you know, my son or daughter, or my cousin or what have you, had an extraordinarily weird and probably uncurable illness. I was told by my doctors, I have a 10% chance to live. Then somebody had the idea, ooh, let's call St. Jude and see what happens. And then within hours, I had plane tickets to Memphis, and within days I was getting treated. And there were many of these stories. It's unreal what they do there. It's just incredible. And they were talking about the Family Commons, which I think we talked about during September last year. But basically, they took an entire floor of the hospital and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to not do hospital things here. We're going to have a salon. We're going to have a place where you can get your nails done. We're going to have classrooms. We're going to have makerspace. They told a story of a young girl that, you know, was terminal. She knew she was, you know, going to pass, and she decided to make an album for her family to listen to after she passed away. Like, I basically cried for three straight days. It was nuts. So I know it's not September. I know we're not quite ready to start to try to guilt you into giving us all, well, not us, giving them all of your money. But let's just say I am so prepared to triple down on giving St. Jude as much of your hard-earned money as we possibly can, because they really do just incredible, incredible work there. And it's so incredibly moving, the work that they do. And, you know, I put a blog post up about this. We'll link it in the show notes. But there's a pavilion of some sort, I think that's what they call it, on campus, where the founders are actually interred. But it's also kind of like a history of St. Jude. And they had this easel sort of thing up. And it says, what inspires you? And they had a bunch of post-it notes, where pre-printed on the post-it notes was, I went to St. Jude and was inspired by. And, you know, I was killing some time, so I was looking around at some of these answers. And a lot of them are just really adorable and cute and whatever. But one of them, and I have pictures of both of these on this blog post, one of them reads, it's clearly in the handwriting of a child, the fact, I went to St. Jude and I was inspired by the fact that I will make it with a heart below it. Like, holy balls. I mean, jeezy, peasy. Then the next one, I went to St. Jude and was inspired by the lives they saved, including mine. I mean, how can you not be excited about this organization? So this was a large part of the reason I was there, is because in September we're going to have a weird recording schedule, because I will be at St. Jude for the Relay FM podcastathon, which is 12 hours of nonstop shenanigans. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. If you've not tuned in, you really should. Even, you know, even if I don't end up going for some strange reason, you should tune in, because it's incredible. And this organization, it really does phenomenal, incredible, important, life-changing, life-saving work. And I'm so proud that the three of us have done so much to raise money for them. I'm so proud to be associated with Relay, who has done so, so much to raise money for them. It's just such an incredible, incredible place. And there's also a really good barbecue real right nearby, which is a nice bonus.
That always helps.
Yeah, that always helps. I had a lot of fun at Memphis. We went to the Pyramid, which is a Bass Pro Shops, which you two Northerners know nothing about. And we also had some barbecue, and we got to visit the pod cabin. So I took a picture with my cardboard cutout from the last podcastathon. If you don't know what I'm talking about, well, you know, you should find out. Watch the podcastathon in September. But it was a really good time. Steven's a great host, and we had a ton of fun. And I'm so excited to go back in September and try to raise a whole pile of money for St. Jude. Let's start with some follow-up. And pretty much the whole of the internet wrote to tell us about this tip, which I had known, but in the heat of the moment, I didn't think of it at all. And so I failed you, John. But friend of the show, Dan Sturm, has come through and told us there is a way to toggle a dimmable light in the Home app and in HomeKit. John, what's the story here?
Secret is you have to tap the icon on the button, not the whole rest of the button, which includes the text and a bunch of other area. A couple people wrote in with the idea that this used to be reversed, and it used to be if you tapped anywhere but the icon, it would toggle the light on and off. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, I tested it, and it does indeed work. I was complaining that every time I go to Control Center or tap the home icon and, you know, try to mess with my lights, it brings up the dimmer. And someone sent me a video, and they said, it doesn't bring up a dimmer for me. It turns my light on and off. It's a dimmable light, but when I tap it, it turns on, and it turns off completely. And I did it on my phone. I'm like, nope, brings up the dimmer for me. And we never would have figured this out until hundreds of people said, yes, you have to tap specifically on the icon. These are very big buttons. They're very big touch targets. And I guess I just always tap on the, you know, three quarters of the button that is not the icon. Maybe it's because I'm using my thumb and I'm coming from the right side because I'm using my right hand. But yeah, that's some slightly undiscoverable UI, but it is good to know. It's not like the icon is small. Now that I know it, I think I'll be able to aim for it. I kind of wish it was reverse, or I still kind of wish you could just say, just make the whole button toggle light on and off. But there you have it. The icon does something different than the whole rest of the button.
Turns out. Pedro Fernandez has some information about the Hayes AT command set. Was this born out of the member special? Is that right? Is that where this started?
Or was that on the main show? We were talking about, like, you know, me getting all these old slow modems slowly over time and still remembering all the AT commands.
So Pedro writes, AT commands are far from being a thing of the past. Oh, no. If you do any kind of development with 4G or 5G connectivity data modules or modems, you talk to them with AT commands. ATA, answer, ATD, dial are all still alive.
Oh,
and yes,
God,
they remain a pain. I've worked on hundreds of systems, and they all require a routine, quote-unquote, cron reboot to make sure that they keep answering those AT commands. Sounds great. Yeah, you don't want to drive 300 miles to unfreeze a 4G or 5G data module. Yeah, that sounds right.
It's amazing that our modern technology and our modern phone systems, things like this, live on.
Indeed.
They really shouldn't.
They really, really shouldn't. But, you know, here we are. All right. TSMC has unveiled advanced 1.6 nanometer process for 2026 chips. Do we eventually get to zero? Is that how this works? Because holy jamoles.
Yeah, as we've discussed before, Moore's law does end because at a certain point you can't make things smaller.
Well, I mean, to be fair, like when I was growing up, I believe these are measured in micrometers. So the unit has just changed to the next smaller unit. I mean, you're right. Eventually, you know, we can't make them smaller because we run into problems of, like, physics. But we are not there yet.
Right. So this was from Mac Rumors from just a few days ago. TSMC yesterday on April 24th unveiled a series of technologies, including the quote-unquote A16 process, which is a 1.6 nanometer node. The A16 technology, which TSMC plans to begin producing in 2026, incorporates innovative nanosheet transistors along with novel backside power rail solution. This development is expected to provide an 8 to 10% increase in speed and 15 to 20% reduction in power consumption at the same speeds compared with TSMC's N2P process, alongside a 1.07 to 1.1x chip density improvement.
I put the story in here for two reasons. One, I had just been discussing on Mastodon, someone had mentioned TSMC's backside power thing, and I'm like, I thought that was an Intel thing. We think we talked about it on a show a while ago where Intel has a technology to send power through the bottom of the chip instead of the top, because if you send it through the top, you got to, like, wiggle it around all the logic to get it to the power spots, where if you send it from the bottom, it's a more direct route and you don't have to do that complicated weaving through all the logic that you put in the chip. So that's interesting. This is confirming that TSMC does have a backside power solution, which is good. And the second reason is they're calling it A16, as if we didn't have enough problems with Macs powered by the M3 Macs and keeping track of the fact that the A5 was the first A-series chip, but it was not in the iPhone 5. Now they're going to call the process A16. We are doomed on this show. They need to come up with new names for things. This is going to be the A19 chip made on the A16 process. Oh, my God.
The M5
chip is not based on the A17 cores. It's based on the A19 cores using the A16 process. We're doomed. I don't know how
we're
going to
handle this. Season of iOS 18, which is also WatchOS 11, which is also VisionOS 2.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And what are we at macOS now? I've forgotten already.
I mean, with all the ridiculousness of like N2B and N2E and N2P, at least it was different than the chips. Oh, God.
Well, you know what? We have some history with naming things. Was it Gray or Marco that originally coined MacBook Adorable?
Gray said adorable. I said one. So
yeah, MacBook okay. One was yeah. Us, and his was
okay.
Adorable,
yeah. Well, we've got that, and we've got the MacBook Escape. If you recall,
that was me
we
too.
Have named things on
no,
the
that
show.
Was one of, I
we
believe that was one of our chat room people who said MacBook Escape, and I like okay. Ran with it. But
well, still, I'm saying as a collective, the three of us plus the chat room, we have coined terms and named things before. We could do it again. We could do it again.
I think. What
we have
learned...
to keep track of. Keep track of our own custom names for the A16. I think they're just making it harder.
Yeah, this is going to be like a verbal version of graffiti where nobody knows what the hell is going on. Mm. Anymore. All right, let's move right along. Rabbit R1 reviews. This is the thing designed by Teenage Engineering, made by the company Rabbit. The reviews are in, and yikes, not looking too good. So, John, you collected a trio of different reviews. You've got Stephen Robles on YouTube, MKBHD on YouTube. We've got The Verge via tech or a blog post about it. It's not looking good, y'all. There it is, y'all. It's not looking good.
Yeah.
All right. So the Stephen Robles video is good because it shows you all the functionality and how poorly it works. The MKBHD one is just a straight review, as you would expect. The MKBHD's title is barely reviewable. The Verge title is a fun, funky, unfinished AI gadget. I recall when we talked about the Rabbit R1 originally, everything was framed as if this works, it's a really good idea. And I think at some point one of us even said, if this works, which it won't. Well, it doesn't.
Well, in all fairness, I'm pretty sure I was always of the don't bet against the smartphone opinion. But
yeah, no, but even setting that aside, just like the whole idea, like what they're trying to do is clever, but it doesn't seem like they're going to be able to do it. Now, the first version, and when I say it doesn't seem like they'll be able to do it, like, will it do the things they say it will do? And the answer right now is no, it doesn't do. It tries to. It tries to do, like, for example, you speak to it and it can order something from DoorDash. But does it order something from DoorDash? Pretty much no. Like, watch the Stephen Robles video. Like, no, he could not make it do the thing. And he's had some follow-up videos with slightly more success, but it takes so long. That's setting aside everything having to do with, like, you know, whether this should be a phone or whatever. It's because it's a small company. It's a new product. It's new technology. It's trying to do new things, which is like, you know, automating the function, automating the use of a UI made for humans, but having a computer do it in response to your voice, right? It's a very clever solution to the problem that a startup like this doesn't have its own large language model, can't do deals with DoorDash, so they have to go around it. It's a very good idea. Execution is not good, even within the constraints of the idea that they had, which is a shame. But, you know, hey, it's $200, which is a third of the price of the Humane pin. And the company seems like a lot more fun. And this is just version one. And if they survive long enough, maybe there'll be a version two and a version three and they'll fix their bug. So even though it seems like you'd put this and the Humane pin in the same bucket of like, oh, they have this idea of the thing you're going to talk to and it's going to do stuff for you. And both of them didn't quite work. I have kinder feelings for the Rabbit R1. Because it's cuter, cheaper, and has a better idea, but neither one of them seems like it's really doing what you want it to do.
I mean, ultimately, yeah, I don't think either of them is a good idea, and I think I've been pretty consistent on this. These are ideas that we, as gadget people and as tech people, we want things like this to succeed. We want them to be good, but ultimately, which I think we'll get to in a second, but ultimately, like, the phone is just going to slaughter all these things, and what we ultimately want is for our phones to just do these things. That's what we want. We don't want to buy and carry and charge and maintain and pay for plans for another device. We just want our phones to do this. And there is really no like technical hardware reason why our phones can't do this. Like it isn't like we need custom hardware to have these kind of AI things. No, we already have it in our phones and maybe our watches too. Like that's where you want this functionality. You want it in the devices we already have, that we have already bought, that are already extremely advanced with their hardware. They're, you know, they're cellular connected. They have amazing processors. They have amazing cameras. They have touch screens that are super easy to navigate stuff on when you do need to look at something or watch or look at controls or whatever. They're already integrated with all of your contacts and everything like that. All the other apps you might want to use in the process. Like, ultimately, what we want is that we want this on our phones, and probably over the next, you know, month and about 7 days, we're probably going to see both major smartphone platform vendors unveil exactly that. Like, I fully expect Google I.O. and WWDC to give us all sorts of promise about things that Android and iPhones will be able to do in the very near future that will make us very rapidly stop talking about this being separate hardware categories. Because
I think part of the reason we talk about it,
though, to be separate hardware categories. This is all destined to just be part of our phones.
The reason we're talking about on this show and the reason these products exist is connected, unfortunately for the people who don't like this topic, to the whole EU, DMA, DOJ, everything, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because the reason these things are standalone devices is they have to be. They have to be, and they want to be, and they have to be. They want to be in that, like, look, if you want to be the next Apple, making an app for the iPhone is not the way to be the next Apple. So if you have ambitions, like, we're going to make the next great platform, and we see an opportunity here where the big players haven't jumped on AI, and we think this is a way that we can get in. So let's imagine this device really did work magically well, and somehow only Rabbit or only Humane had the secret sauce to make it work, and they had a couple year head start on Apple, and they're like, if we can get big and we can get going, yes, we're at a big disadvantage, but like maybe we'll outrun them or whatever. Obviously, that has not happened, right? So they want to be their own, but also they have to be their own, because to make anything like this, and I think there is some reason to have separate hardware, as in like a thing with a camera that you pin to your lapel or whatever, is that the integration they need with the phone platforms, they tend not to be able to get. Certainly with Apple, I'm not sure with Android, but like, for example, you can't replace Siri on the iPhone. So if your ambition is to be a much better Siri, but replace Siri on the phone, that would be great. Everyone's got the phones, we're charging them, they're incredibly powerful, someone else runs the platform, you don't have to do it. But, oh, Apple doesn't let you replace Siri, do they? Mm-hmm. And they don't let you integrate with their phone so tightly that you, hell, like I said, it's almost like Apple doesn't let its own watch integrate that well with it, because there's so much connectivity issues between the watches and phones. It's gotten better over time, but still. So there was a story in 9to5Mac that said, AI hardware is like trying to invent the iPod after the iPhone. And in the whole story, not once did they mention the fact that these companies are forced to do this because the people who own the platforms are not interested in allowing a third party to essentially be a peripheral to the phone. And that's what we want. Like with these devices, you know, AirPods are a great example. They are a peripheral to the phone. Imagine if AirPods tried to be a standalone device with a little computer. I mean, they do have little computers, but like a standalone device with its own OS doing everything all on itself, right? Connecting to cellular and Wi-Fi, and just like they didn't connect to the phone at all, right? That's like what these companies are doing. You're like, why would you do that? We have phones and they have amazing computing power. And it's like, yeah, but I can't integrate with them in the way I need to, right? So AirPods are great, but imagine something with like a camera or a lapel or a microphone, like auxiliary hardware, a peripheral for your phone, a thing that you don't have to take out of your pocket, but of course uses your phone to do all the stuff. That's what these products want to be, but can't be. So the fact that these companies are trying to do things that we think are there, the reason they're technically clever is because they're working around a unfortunate business situation, which is they can't be the products they want to be. But every time one of these products gets funded, tries to do this and fails, and we look at it and say, that's a clever way to try to work around a sort of unfair market. That is reinforcement to all of these court cases and regulations or whatever, saying this is not a competitive market where innovation can flourish, because basically we have to sit back and wait until Google and Apple decide that they're going to do something. And at WWDC, Apple will do something, and Google already is doing things. But like, we don't want to have to wait for these two companies to decide what kind of things they want to do. People have other ideas, and they would like to do them, but asking them to say, to do that, you have to start from zero, build your own platform, your own everything, be completely independent of the phone, because the phone companies are never, not the phone companies, but you know what I mean, are never going to give you the integration you need. That's why this is mostly a story about the sort of awkward shape of the market. And, you know, people are cleverly trying to get around it. And it's not like they're all doomed to failure. Again, if AI was better than it was and one of these companies really hit it out of the park, there is a couple years of runway before these big companies try to buy you, where you could get out ahead and start doing something. Like, what did we see recently with maybe you could say maybe the Pebble Watch got a little traction before the Apple Watch squished it. Every once in a while, there's like something that pops out that gets out ahead of one of the big tech giants before the tech giants wake up and smush it. In this case, they don't, they kind of self-smushed. But I give them points for trying, and especially Rabbit, I give a lot of points for coming up with a low-cost, clever attempt to work around the giants. But yeah, this is not what we want. We want our AirPods to let us yell things into the air. We want a little tiny lapel microphone or camera to see everything around us and explain everything. And we want a pair of glasses to put name tags over people's heads. We're not quite there yet.
There are a couple of interesting things about this. First of all, I thought it was very, very well done. I think this was mentioned in the 9 to 5 Mac link that Dave2D, who's a YouTuber, I put together a clip of this that I'll put in the show notes, but is looking at the Rabbit and says, well, you know, he does a much better version than me, but, you know, well, what if we took this, like the push to talk button and moved it to the other side and actually let's make them volume buttons. And then we can do like the push to talk button, maybe somewhere else. We can put the camera on the back. Now we've got a lot more space for the screen. Oh, look, we've made a phone. Like, yeah. You know, just by making the things, and this is coming back to what you were saying, Marco, like by making the thing work better for the thing it's trying to accomplish, you've just reinvented the smartphone.
I mean, and the Rabbit does run Android, and it is, people have discovered that basically the thing it's running is essentially an Android app that you can take, you can rip off of the Rabbit and put it on Android phone and run it there.
I love that this is like a big story. Like, of course that's what it is. Like, that's
like, wait,
so
did you think they wrote
much
their own operating system like the Play-Doh?
Right. Like, well, like, I mean, yeah, that's fairly unusual. And like, so much of you know, modern hardware devices, like my scanner is just an Android app. Like, there's
and
so
Android, and Android, of course, is just Linux, and what the language is running is just Java, right?
Yeah, like there's a whole bunch of hardware out there that is quote just an Android app running on some kind of commodity, mm-hmm. you know, Android tablet kind of guts, and you know, and it just so happens, oh, here's a scanner with a touch screen. Like, well, what do you think is powering that? Like, yeah, a lot of times it's Android. It's fine. Like, that's people made a big deal out of this. Oh my God, it's just an app. Like, yeah, of course, that's not a story. The story is,
you wouldn't
expect
them to write their own
smartphones. That's the story.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, so why didn't you just make a phone? Oh, well, making a phone, first off, you just made another Android phone. Great. Now you're just another Android phone vendor. That's a tough business. It's competitive. Like, making a good Android phone is not an easy thing to do. And second, they didn't want to just make an Android phone. They wanted to be like the next big thing. And that's why they're taking a stab in this direction. Now, I don't know what the integration situation is like on Android. Can you replace like the Google Assistant on like Google or Samsung branded Android phones or any of the Android phones that matter? How open is it to you integrating to sort of an always reliable, always connected type of high speed, low latency connection between a peripheral and the thing, you know, more than just Bluetooth, right? I don't know what that situation is like, but obviously none of these companies were interested in going that route. They tried to be as standalone as they could possibly be, and being standalone is a tough gig. That's kind of the other thing the Rabbit did, and Humane for that matter. No apps. Why no apps? Do you want to try to run a platform? Do you know what's involved with trying to run a platform and vending APIs and tools? And like, that's insane. Like, there have been very few successful computing platforms in our entire lives. You can like count them on like fingers and toes, right? There's not that many of them. Running one successfully is incredibly hard. So these things are like, we're not even going to try to do that. We're just going to like be an appliance, a magical appliance through the use of AI. Maybe we can be independent. And unfortunately, the magic they relied on were LLMs that are not up to this job. Which is a shame.
The other thing I thought was fascinating about this was watching the reactions from the press, from my own like gut reaction. We don't need to belabor this, but you know, the Humane people were talking about how they're, you know, God's gift to software and hardware development, and how, oh, we're the best, we're revolutionizing, we're destroying the smartphone. Look at us and how smart we are and our colorways and this and that. And everyone pooped all over them because they deserved it. With this, the reaction I've seen is, yeah, it's kind of trash, but man, it's cute and it's fun and it's cheap. So who cares? And it's just so funny to me that an ounce of humility, it really does go a long way. And when you're not trying to convince everyone that you're the second coming, it turns out people are more receptive to even when things aren't perfect. Although I will say the Jesse fellow seemed to be kicking rocks in Humane's direction an awful lot lately. But I still think the broader point is fair that maybe just don't be a jerk and things will work out a little better for you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Rabbit was just so much more pragmatic. It's such a cheaper device. The hardware is cute, but also cheap, right? Their business model of trying to work around the big companies. You know, I don't know, people are like, $200, that's not cheap. Compared to $600, it is. Like, if you're going to blow $200 on something that doesn't work, it feels much better than blowing $600 on it. I mean, they put a screen on it. Another example, they're like, well, let's just, how about we have a screen? How about that? Instead of like a laser projector, right? Simpler, cheaper. You know, it just, it shows more pragmatic choices, but in the end, like, they're, you know, they're doomed to failure, but like, it just, it's a tough gig to coming out with a product like that with so much attention on you for a 1.0.
It is.
Yeah. It doesn't, and I think both of them, I'm going to say they don't work like spectacular failures, but it's pretty big failure when it's not like, oh, it's a little slower, it's a little clunky, it's a little buggy. Like, both of them have cases where they just simply do not do what the product is supposed to do. And that is not really shippable, but they both ship. So there you have it.
All right, moving along. Riley Tested has some feedback and information, not specifically to us, but just general feedback with regard to Delta availability. So a toot from Riley. Getting some questions about Delta availability. I hope this clarifies things. Delta is exclusive to Alt Store in the EU. Because of Apple's new developer terms, all downloads in the EU cost us 50 euro cents a year in Alt Store PAL and the App Store. So we couldn't offer Delta in the EU app stores without making it paid. App Store only supports one-time paid upfront apps, so we'd have to pick a price that could support years of the core technology fee. Alt Store PAL's $1 or 1 euro, excuse me, and 50 cent cost covers Delta's core technology fee, and they would choose to make everything free everywhere if it wasn't for the core technology fee. So, I mean, you made this bed, EU, so now you got to sleep in it.
That's more like Apple made the bed. Why is it exclusive to the Alt Store in the EU? Because of the CTF.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's, I think, a little column A, a little column B, but you're more right than wrong. All right, moving along, iPad OS has been identified as a quote-unquote digital gatekeeper under the new EU tech rules. So picking some snippets from Mac Rumors, last September, the European Commission designated Apple as a gatekeeper for its iOS iPhone operating system, its web browser Safari, and its App Store. On the same day, the Commission opened a market investigation to whether iPad OS constitutes an important gateway for business users to reach end users in order to determine if it should be designated as a gatekeeper. That investigation is now closed. According to an EC press release shared on Monday, the Commission's investigation found that Apple presents the features of a gatekeeper in relation to iPad OS for the following reasons. Apple, number one, Apple's business user numbers exceeded the quantitative threshold 11-fold, while its end user numbers were close to the threshold and predicted to rise in the near future. Number two, end users are locked into iPad OS. Apple leverages its large ecosystem to disincentivize end users from switching to other operating systems for tablets. And number three, business users are locked into iPad OS because of its large and commercially attractive user base and its importance for certain use cases such as gaming apps. The Commission has now given Apple a six-month deadline to fully comply with the obligations set by the DMA, which means we should expect enforced changes in iOS and iPad OS, like alternative app stores, web distribution, and alternative browsers. And that should all come to iPad OS as well in a forthcoming update.
I think the reasons are like, well, we have a bunch of criteria. I bet almost meets them, but whatever. It's the same thing, right? I don't see why they need to like justify it or have some kind of rules. Like, it's kind of weird that iPad OS didn't get folded in to begin with, but they went through this little dance to say, you know what? Yep, iPad OS too. And you know, arguably, potentially one of many possible motivations for Apple renaming, you know, iPad OS to be its own OS was to try to make it distinct in all legal circumstances or whatever. But the thing is, the EC can do whatever the hell they want, and this is what they want to do. So. And it just honestly, it makes it simpler because I half the time I'm always forgetting, oh yeah, yep. There's no alternative marketplaces on iPad OS, but now there will be, and it's more consistent for Apple, it's more consistent for users, it just makes more sense. So
yep, I mean, this is good. This is good work, EU. Mark Gurman writes, no Apple Vision 2 launch planned before the end of 2026. So no FOMO for, well, I was going to say Mark and me, but I guess just me until the end of 2026. From Mac Rumors again, Gurman says that Apple's latest Vision Pro roadmap quote, doesn't currently call for a second generation model until the end of 2026, quote. In February of 2024, he said that the device was at least 18 months away. According to Gurman's sources, Apple's still trying to figure out a way to bring a cheaper version to market before then, although the company remains flummoxed by how exactly to bring down the cost. It's kind of tangentially related. I don't recall if we said this on the show, but they did actually release the second episode of the, what is it, Encounter Dinosaurs or something like immersive video. Yeah, this was like a week or two ago, actually, and I think it might have been right after we recorded last, and because of our travel, it's been a wonky recording schedule for us. But it has been released, and it's another like five-minute thing, and it was fine. I did have somebody reach out on Mastodon and said, hey, I worked on this, and just so you know, it's I was going to say historically accurate. I guess that's not the right turn of phrase. It's scientifically accurate based on the understanding that we have today. So like things that should have feathers and colors are as best as we think they could be at the time. I won't be able to dig up these toots to link to them. I'm sorry. But I did find that fascinating. But in terms of like a compelling cinematic experience, it was fine.
Yeah, I guess that's what this means. I mean, waiting this long for a new model to come out, like that's, you know, really putting more cold water on top of the Apple Vision Pro market. But what it basically means is the parts in this that are expensive are not getting cheaper fast enough for Apple to come out with a substantially cheaper model sooner, it seems like. And what I assume what that means is the screens, right? Because we know that the M series SoCs, the cost of those, you know, they're not the most expensive component in this thing anyway, and Apple has some control over that. And the aluminum and stuff, well, that's kind of the same. Yes, they could make it cheaper by dropping the screen, by dropping the front screen. But the screens that are in front of your eyeballs are not made by a lot of companies, are not in wide supply, and apparently are not going to get cheap enough, fast enough for Apple to come out with something sooner. So this is going to be a long wait with the one. This is like, who would have predicted that the Apple, like the glasses, the goggles, the VR, whatever we were talking about, the headset, what we were talking about before this was released, that they will end up being essentially an HomePod-like product where they release one and it sits there and people go, is Apple still doing this thing? Or and so I don't, it's not a good a good comparison when people start thinking of your product the same way they think of the HomePod, the big HomePod, that is. But if this is true and there's not any other Vision Pro hardware until the end of 2026, that's HomePod vibes.
Well, and I don't think that's, you know, people are making a big deal out of that news. I don't think that's that surprising. I think the bigger surprise for me with this launch is that Apple seems to be putting no wood behind the arrow. Like there's just like no content besides one episode of Dinosaurs, I guess. Cool. But like that's the part that surprises me. What this product needs, it needs to be radically cheaper. But you know, as you mentioned, like there's some pretty critical, you know, inhibitions to making it cheaper that are going to stay that way for probably at least like 5 years. Like, you know, we're not close to making it cheaper, at least a lot cheaper. Like, you know, you could make it a little bit cheaper with some of the cuts here and there, as you were mentioning. But like, it's not really close to being a lot cheaper. So it's not going to be a mass market priced device for some time, if ever. So in the meantime, all right, how do you make what it is, this $3,500 plus device, how do you make that valuable to the people who will buy it, who can afford it? And that's the part, that's the surprise to me, is that there doesn't seem to be a lot happening there yet. Like, I would have assumed that Apple, since there really was no, like, you know, competitive pressure to release this when they did, I would have assumed it would be more like, you mentioned the Playdate a little bit earlier, Casey. Like, I assumed it would be more like the Playdate, where, like, when Panic launched the Playdate, they had, like, a whole year of games that were, like, planned and scheduled. It's like,
yeah,
all right,
that's a really good point.
Every week after it was launched, a new game came out. And they had all this content lined up and all these deals with developers lined up. And so they knew that, yes, we're selling a brand new hardware platform with no installed base and no software library that will be there when we get there, so we have to create that. So they did. Like, and that was a great strategy. It worked very well. I assumed that Apple was releasing it when they were because they had plans to give it a real, you know, oomph kind of release. And that seems to not have been the case.
Apple doesn't have panic money, you know. I mean, how many people does Panic have? They're such a big corporation with huge staff, incredibly well resourced. You can't really expect Apple to compete with that.
Right, right.
Exactly.
So I mean,
what the Vision Pro needs. Like, what it needs is reasons for the people who are willing to spend $3,500, which, again, that's not going to be mass market for some time. But there is a market for high-end luxury electronics. Like, those markets exist. They're not massive, but they exist. Apple has served them in other ways before. That's largely what some of their products serve already. There is a market there at the current price, but even at the current price, Apple's not really addressing the market in other non-price ways. And if they launched a brand new hardware revision, you know, in 6 months or a year instead of this rumor of 2026 or whatever, like, if they launched one earlier, that's not going to change that. Like, what's holding it back right now is mostly not the hardware. It's the price, which won't change for a long time, and the ecosystem and the software just kind of not, like, what's the killer app? Where's the killer content? That's what they need now. They don't need more hardware releases. They need apps and content.
Well, they kind of need both. I mean, like, I know one was kind of more important than the other, but, like, the reason I compared it to the HomePod is when people don't see updates to a product year over year, especially for, like, 3 years in a row, they start to wonder about the company's commitment, and that's really death for a new platform. And even though new hardware, like, it's not going to be that different within a year or two. Like, the technology's not advancing that quickly. But it does show, oh, Apple's still committed to this. They've made some, even if it's just like physical changes, like we have a little bit better ideas for straps now that we've put these out in the field, and we have a little bit a better idea about fit, right? Even if it's exactly the same screen, still an M2, like just minor revisions shows that the company is committed to the product. And no, that's not going to move the market, but it will make people feel a little bit more comfortable, especially if you're, you know, a tech gadget fan, that like Apple is committed to this. Obviously content also would do that to make you know that Apple's committed to it. But if they just released content and everyone was loving it, 3 years in, they'd be like, okay, I love it so much, but what, they need to release more of this and they need to make a cheaper one because no one's going to buy this because it's too expensive. And I think it's great, but you know, there's two things. There's one, it does need to get better. Like at some point in some number of years, there should be a better, technically better version, but of course that will be equally expensive or even more expensive. And then there also needs to be a cheaper one. But right now it looks kind of like the original HomePod in multiple ways, in that like maybe they'll be sitting in warehouses unsold like the big HomePods were. And then when Apple does come out with the new one, it'll be like the HomePod Mini. They'll be like, you know what? We just kind of decided that people actually just need a cheaper, worse one of these, like the HomePod Mini, and we'll just stop making the big one. Oh, but we changed our mind. We'll make the big one again, and here's a better one. Like, that's not a good path for instilling confidence. And the HomePod's not even a platform. The HomePod is not a platform. It's just a thing that people stick in their house. This is a platform, and so you need people to believe in it. You need developers to believe in it. You need users to believe in it. You need to have it show signs of life. And one of the ways you can show signs of life is don't wait 3 years between changing the hardware at all. I mean, see also the Mac Pro.
Right. And I mean, I think it's really, it's been extremely surprising for me, like you were saying a moment ago, Marco, that there really hasn't been much of a push for content. Like since the launch, what have we gotten? We've gotten the MLS thing that everyone hated, including me. We've gotten a second Dinosaurs episode, and that's it, right? Like,
yeah.
Other than some bug fixes and mild improvements to the OS and some legitimately pretty solid improvements to personas, and the addition of spatial personas, but even still, like, that's not that much. And you would think, and I think the Playdate is a just perfect case study in how to do this right. You would think that they knew when this was going to come out and they would have queued up a whole bunch of this content, and it seems like they just didn't. And
they didn't even have Netflix and YouTube app.
talk
about like a way to get content for quote unquote for free. Like, hey, Netflix has content, YouTube has content. It had to be third parties to like make these own kind of, you know, WebKit enabled screen scraping clients to try to do something useful out of it. Yeah, it's not been a good. I think we're still waiting on those coming soon new environments, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, and again,
are those going to come out the end of 2026 too?
That's the thing, like, you know,
yeah, fair.
Like, so, you know, Netflix and YouTube, those are third parties. There's lots of reasons why that's kind of out of Apple's control. Some of which are their fault, but still, like, you know, that's not within their control directly. Whereas there are
things, they could have thrown more money at it.
They could have maybe. I mean, but you know, that's more of like, you know, a corporate politics thing. Like, I get that's kind of a bigger picture problem for them. But there are things within Apple's power to do that they seem to not have done yet. So, for instance, you know, they do have content studios. They could be making more of this content. They could have made it in advance. You know, certain deals they could make with other content providers. You know, things like the sports leagues. I'm sure those are all like in progress or in talks. But you need something there now for people to use this device with now. And then, of course, other things that they could make themselves directly, like things like the environments we were saying,
or their own apps.
Yeah, or exactly, or the built-in apps that are, you know,
every Apple app that shipped as an iPad app on the Vision Pro is kind of like,
right. And so that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, people, I know this comes up occasionally. I want you to know out there, audience, when we criticize Apple, we get heat from you, from other Apple fans. So we don't criticize Apple, you know, unnecessarily or with, you know, cavalierly. This is just like, no matter how much we all want the Vision Pro to succeed because it is amazing technology, like we all are rooting for this. We were rooting for this. We still are rooting for this to succeed. We want this to succeed. But it just looks like Apple is fumbling the ball so badly. Sorry for the sports analogy. I'm not good with sports. But like, it just looks like they just were not prepared to have actually launched this. And it almost seems like we have more faith in the product than large parts of Apple do, and that's concerning. And the problem is, if they don't put a bunch of wood behind that arrow, no one's going to buy it and keep it and keep using it, and the platform will fail, even though it's an amazing piece of hardware. And so for this to succeed, if the outcome that we want is for this product to succeed, we should be bugging Apple from the outside and be like, hey, you know, you got to like do something here, right? Like, you know, this is not going to fix itself. Like, this, the situation in the Vision Pro right now, over time, this is not going to get better unless changes are made. Like, this isn't something that will work itself out. This is like, it isn't like, oh, we're just right around the corner from a bunch of apps being made for it. Like, I keep seeing my Overcast usage graph go down on the Vision Pro. It is now about 120 people. And that's not good. And so, like, what I see is the slope going down, 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 down. That does not tell me that I, as a developer, should invest in this platform. And what about content makers? What about Netflix? What about YouTube? They're seeing the same graphs, I'm sure, of whatever data they have showing how many of their potential customers might be using this thing. And those graphs are also probably going down. From a pretty low number to begin with. And so, again, like, if you follow this out, what's going to happen? How is this going to look 6 months from now? How is this going to look a year from now? If nothing changes significantly, it's going to look very bad. It's going to be, you know, just a continuation of this downward slope with almost no one left using it. So something has to change in order to make that go up, and it's not going to come from the outside because the outside parties have no reason to do it. So it has to come from Apple. Apple has to be the one to make that change.
Another potentially helpful analogy is Apple TV. For longtime Apple fans, remember what the Apple TV was when it was introduced as iTV. It was a Mac running a modified version of Tiger, macOS 10.4, and it had a hard drive, and it was very different from what you see today. But it was essentially similar product, similar job, an Apple-connected thing that you connect to your television and it helps you watch TV. And it took a while for that platform to find whatever legs it has. There was a long time where Apple itself would refer to it as a hobby project to sort of undercut it and tamp down expectations. That is not how the Vision Pro was launched, to say the least, as a hobby product, right? But that did sort of give it, you know, they had to figure out, like, what should this be a Mac? Should it run Mac OS X? Should it have a hard drive? Like, what is the right role for this product? You know, kind of like the HomePod, you know, what is the right shape of this product? Are we barking up the wrong tree? And the change from the original Apple TV / iTV to the current one is big, but it shows that if the company is patient and is willing to plug away at it, the Apple TV took how many years to see any kind of success to even be good, but Apple didn't give up on it. They just rethought, regrouped, tried a couple times, made a couple of really bad remotes. It still has a lot of problems, but it is better than it was. If you don't give up, and you're willing to keep putting money into it, and you do actually do occasional updates, you can make progress. But again, Apple TV as a platform, I think, is not where Apple wants Vision Pro to be as a platform. And Apple TV was not launched with the same fanfare as Vision Pro. So there is definitely a mismatch between what Apple is saying about the Vision Pro and how much it costs and how they launched it. And the actual, the reality of the product is a lot more like that original Apple TV or the big HomePod. But the launch is like it's the iPhone, and it's not.
All right. It is time for the 2018 to 2022 iPad Pro exit interview. And I don't know, Marco, this is kind of your baby. Do you have any opening statement? Do you want to start? Do you want to poll the crowd?
So we, you know, whenever we think that a new product or more recently OS version is about to be unveiled, like we'll do one right before WWDC for iOS 17, et cetera. I started doing this a few years ago on this show here, doing these exit interviews, because, of course, I have lots of experience with corporate America and managing people. And so I know how to conduct such things, obviously. So here we are on the eve of what is almost certain to be the iPad Pro update event. Maybe other iPads as well. We'll see. But the iPad Pro is probably about to be replaced before or right on our next show. And so I feel like the current iPad Pro technically came out in 2022, but it really has not changed much on the outside since 2018. That was a major revision, the 2018 – that was when the 11-inch was released, when they got the flat sides, the magnetic pencil, like all that stuff. And so that was – what was that? Yeah, right. Face ID, like the you know, they lost the home button. That was a major revision. It was a great revision. There are some, you know, I've had some nitpicks with it over time, but overall, I think it's really been a fantastic product. And kind of going into the what is most likely to be the update, I think my opinions of the outgoing one frame what I want out of the update and what I hope Apple has addressed with it. And for me, Even when I very first got the other iPad Pro in 2018, number one thing I wanted was move the Face ID sensor to either the corner or the long edge, so that way you can use it in landscape mode, which is how I almost always use it, usually with a keyboard. Move it, have it in landscape mode, and not have your hand cover the Face ID sensor when you pick it up. And it seems like that is something like that is rumored. It has been rumored for a while. One of the more recent iPad base models actually did that. They actually moved the Face ID camera to the top because they realized, like, oh yeah, it turns out a lot of people use iPads in landscape now. And I think overall, what I dislike about the outgoing iPad is, first of all, not much, because I think it was a very, very good product for a very long time. It is, you know, it's getting a little old in the tooth now. Long in the tooth, I guess. It's getting a little old now. I would love to see, like, some basic improvements of kind of just, you know, little, just like things we've learned along the way. And for me, the major theme for things we've learned along the way since 2018 is, I think way more people now than back then really use the iPad configured physically like a laptop. There is some kind of keyboard, whether it's one of Apple's many options for keyboards for the iPad, or whether it's a third-party keyboard case, whatever. I think many, many people now, we now know this has been a thing for some time, many people use the iPads with keyboards, and I'm one of them. I really never used an iPad regularly until the Apple keyboard covers, because they were just so good. But, again, the iPad, it was never seemingly designed to be used in landscape orientation. And, you know, it does it, but, like, again, like, the Face ID and the camera were in the wrong spot for it. The volume buttons and everything. Like, everything on it is clearly in the wrong spot when you turn it on its side for landscape orientation. So I would like to see an iPad Pro. You know, whatever they choose to do with the other ones, whatever, that's up to them. But the iPad Pro, I think, is maybe more likely than the others to be used with either a keyboard, the Apple Pencil, or both. Because that's... It's a high-end device. It used to be that those are the only ones that could use the pencil and you know, the best keyboards and everything. So I would like to see the new iPad Pro be actually designed to be better used with optionally a keyboard and pencil. And for me, number one thing for that is, of course, moving the camera to the long edge. But a very, very close number two, I want the keyboard to be able to physically attach to the iPad Pro in a better way than just having a giant face full of magnets that forms an entire back cover that sticks to the back of it. And it turns out we have better ways. They're called holes. I want the iPad Pro to add some kind of holes or slot or some kind of physical, like, clip kind of thing, something that the keyboard can clip into. So that way, a keyboard could literally just be the flat bottom part of what we see now as the keyboard cases and not have a back case. And sure, maybe
you
can
make
those...
Sounds like you want a laptop.
Yes, sure. But what I want, and this can be accomplished in a very nice, graceful way if Apple chooses to do it. I'm not talking about, like, massive, like, you know, a big slot like a Palm Pilot, although that would be nice for the pencil, but we'll get to that in a second. But, like, I'm not talking about, like, some kind of giant slot that runs the whole length of the thing. This could be, like, you know, like, the roughly the size of the millimeter wave window on an iPhone, on the side of the iPhones, the recent ones. Like, just like a little, like... a little oval inset into it with some latch mechanism inside that a keyboard could be designed to latch into. That's what I want because, first of all, attaching things with magnets is great. It is great when you have no other options, when it is the best option. It isn't always the best option. It is especially not always the best option with the Apple Pencil. And this is, I'll get to that now, I guess. The Apple Pencil always falls off the iPad Pro. When you bring it in and out of any bag ever, the pencil will fall off. That's not great, obviously. Like, you don't want that. Many pencils have been lost or have fallen into bags or airline seat gaps or whatever from this reason. I would love to see some consideration for the physical form of the iPad Pro to better attach physically pencils and keyboards. I don't think this is going to happen, frankly. I think this is even less likely than the M4 rumor. Like, I think this is very, very unlikely to be the design. But that's what ultimately I want. And again, it could just be as simple as, like, you know, a couple of, like, oval cutouts that something could poke into with strong metal and maybe have, like, a little expanding latch part that expands out and latches it in or something like that. Like, it could be that simple. And what that would allow is, first of all, way more graceful attachment of keyboards, way more secure attachment of pencils, and the keyboard could then be like half the weight. It could be way smaller, way lighter, way mechanically simpler, which maybe could allow them to lower the obscene prices of those smart keyboards. And then the resulting package would be much more size and weight competitive with similarly sized laptops, because right now it's really not. Like, right now, like, the when you put a keyboard case on an iPad Pro, it's really not that size competitive or weight competitive with, you know, compared to just small laptops, especially the 12.9 inch one. So it gets pretty bulky, pretty heavy, pretty bulky. I would love so much for them to fix this problem. Just put, like, some kind of physical notch or something into the iPad body. You know, I feel like the Jony Ive school of design is, let's make everything a smooth, featureless blob that, you know, we can show it floating in space in a white room in a product video, and it just looks like a perfect uninterrupted form. And the problem is, that is not super compatible with many realities. And so in reality, then, we have to, like, wrap things around it or bolt things to it with magnets or have cables coming out in weird ways. Like, that's the reality. I would love for the products to be more designed to accommodate the reality of what they actually need, how they're actually used. That way, the way most people actually end up using them can be more graceful and can work better. So that's what I want. I don't think I'm going to get it, but I want that more than I want any other predicted feature. Like, that's more important to me than the M4 or the M3 or AI. It's more important to me than OLED screens even. Sorry, John. Like, that's what I really want, is for them to finally make the iPad Pro designed to accommodate actually using it more like a laptop. And it won't happen.
Well, you just want a touchscreen laptop running iPad OS.
Yeah, seriously.
Just cut to the chase.
No, but it's so convertible. It would still be convertible. In fact, it would be more easily convertible. You just pop it right out.
Yeah, so, the holes idea is interesting, but I don't think actually solves the main problem, which is the weight distribution, because all of the computing guts are in the quote-unquote screen part. You can't actually just do a laptop-style hinge, so you still have to have, like, a cantilevered out area in the back, which makes it clumsy. I mean, I know what you're saying about, like, instead of having the magnets on the back, have an attachment point, and that saves you some weight there, but most people want to protect their pack of their iPads anyway, so... I don't know. I think you'd have to really sketch this out to try to come up with something that actually is both lighter weight and sturdier with the addition of holes, but it's a tough sell, and I don't think they're going to go in that direction. But for just my brief thing in the exit interview for the current one, I think that it was a really important design in the evolution of the iPad, in particular the flat-sided pencil that sticks to it, even though, yes, it does come off. It is better than the previous pencil, which didn't stick to it at all.
Way better.
Right? So it was a big, important step, and I think basically it only stayed around for, like, one generation too long, right? Like, it was the last time when it didn't get revised and just got new guts on the inside, and when the iPad 10th gen or whatever got the landscape camera and everything, it was so clear. It was like, ooh, yeah, this year, it's kind of a shame, the iPad Pro. But that's just one year, right? They're still, and they still updated. They still did update the guts. I think this revision is not going to be as radical as you want it to be, but I think it is going to have some things for you. And I think we can, Casey, do you have any iPad Pro exit interview stuff before we dive into the announcement?
A little bit. I had bought a 2018 iPad Pro, loved it. That's now been pushed down the hierarchy to be the kids' iPad, predominantly Michaela at this point, but, you know, Declan will use it from time to time. And I had bought the 2022, right? M2 iPad Pro to replace it, both 11 inches. And I love that one. And I absolutely adore that as an around the house computer, as an in the car, as a passenger computer, things of that nature. You know, one thing that the iPad has up on the Mac, and at the rate we're going, we'll always have up on the Mac, is Marco
cellular.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just remind you, Apple. Shattering?
Yes,
it's also windshield shattering. Yes, that's true. Let me remind you, Apple, I will pay you infinite dollars to give me a cellular MacBook Pro, please, for the love of God. I will give you all of my money. But anyway, I really like my iPad in very limited use cases. But those use cases, it is freaking perfect for it. I don't particularly disagree with anything Marco was saying with regard to, like, cases and things like that. I use the cantilevered, what is it, Magic Keyboard? Is that right? I always get them backwards. We have on Michaela's iPad.
The more expensive cantilevered one. The smart keyboard cover is the one that I use and Craig Federighi uses. That is just, it used to be the only one. It was like, there's no trackpad, right. And it's like a little bit shorter up front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I do have one of those. That's what's on Michaela's iPad. And I use that until the cantilevered one, the magic one, came out. And I do think, and I think you had said this, Marco, I started using the iPad way more when I had a real keyboard on it, because then, to me anyway, it becomes completely hamstrung for creation purposes to occasionally annoying, which is a big improvement, actually. And so I really like both of the iPads that are in the house. The biggest issue I would say I have with the 2022 iPad is that it's not really that much better than the 2018. Like, it's noticeably better, but not night and day better, even though, you know, 4 years had elapsed. And I think the only thing that I seek, now we're leaving the exit interview part, sorry, John, but the only thing I really seek from a new one, first of all, I don't plan to buy one, remind me of this in a week, but the only thing I really seek is I would love to have the FaceTime, the front-facing camera, on the longer edge. But, like, the pencil, yeah, it falls off all the time, but at least it can connect. That doesn't really bother me. The cantilever keyboard is heavy, but it's, you know, I love that thing. I think it's worth the weight. It's worth the cost. Although I will say Mine is not aging super gracefully. I feel like we just talked about this a few weeks back, but the corner, one of the corners of mine is looking real gross. And like the outer shell, like the kind of rubbery outer shell has fallen away. There's definitely some other spots that have like nicks and whatnot that it's not aged extraordinarily gracefully. So maybe a little bit better keyboard. And actually come to think of it, you know, and now that I'm wish casting, bigger trackpad, which is a common refrain. You know, I think Jason and Mike talked about this. The Connected Boys talked about this bigger trackpad. And for the love of all that is good and holy, an escape key and function row, please and thank you. I would love that on a future keyboard. But in the grand scheme of things, the hardware itself, like, it's fine. It's quick. It's got cellular. I don't have any strong needs for the Apple Pencil. I do have one. And when I use it, I really, really like it. But I'm not an artist. I use it more for, like, you know, annotating things than anything else. So I don't know. I don't even know what I'm seeking right now. This is one of those moments where Apple needs to tell me what it is I have missed all of my life, because I don't know what it is right now.
Well, I mean, what we're not talking about, which is we have no reason to talk about it until the WWDC, is the OS, which, as we always say, is the main thing that's holding it back. But we're not getting a new OS for the iPad on May 7th. That'll wait till WWDC. So we have to set that aside. We're just talking about the hardware. But honestly, one big part of the problem with the iPad is that the OS has never lived up to the hardware. The hardware is essentially laptop. It's an Apple laptop without the keyboard running a slightly different OS, but the OS does not allow that power to be exploited, and it's a shame. But you know, that's not going to change on May 7th. So the event didn't come out and say this is an iPad event, but it did have what it have. It had had a bunch of different images. I got the one that had someone holding an Apple Pencil, which might be the first time that Apple literally put the product they're going to announce in the image, right? Because it's so clearly an Apple Pencil. It's not like a regular pencil. It's an Apple Pencil. But there were apparently six possible images that you can get, and they were all kind of abstract, look like they were drawn with the pencil or whatever. And then Tim Cook tweeted, "Pencil us in for May 7th," and then did a little pencil emoji. Gone are the days of subtlety, you know, it's like the AI announcement for WWDC. But anyway, you would think that they're going to have an event on May 7th where they're going to announce an Apple Pencil and that's it. I think there will be other things, but just FYI, there's going to be a new Apple Pencil. So that's great. But the actual iPad, as I said earlier in the year, I think is the hardware product I'm most excited for this year because I'm definitely going to get one if the rumors are true and it has an OLED screen, because I use my iPad as a little tiny television. And OLED is better for TVs. The black levels on the current 11-inch iPad Pro are very bad. And OLED won't have that problem. And so I'm excited for it. And honestly, from a hardware perspective, it's basically a big screen. So any improvement to the screen is significant. And from what the rumors say, this is a very significant upgrade to the screen. So significant that I think this will be the best screen that Apple sells, period.
The Vision Pro is having some thoughts right now.
There's the question of whether those are screens, but even within that realm, I think this one will have better color reproduction and brightness than the Vision Pro ones do. Maybe not as high a resolution, but better color reproduction and brightness, and also you don't have to strap it to your head. Right? But just for traditional screens, setting aside things that are inside goggles, for traditional screens, I think this is going to beat everything that they sell if the rumors are true. It's supposedly a dual stacked OLED. So the problem with OLEDs is you can't make them too bright or they wear themselves out and use a lot of power. So instead, they take two OLEDs and put them on top of each other and run each one at slightly lower power. So each individual OLED doesn't wear itself out as fast, but the total light throughput you get is, I don't know if it's double, but it's more, right? So that is fascinating. And if it is a really good screen, as the rumors suggest, I'm going to love it because this is my little miniature TV. So I know that's not exciting to most people, except for maybe color reproduction for people who are trying to do like professional photo or video work on it or whatever. And although good luck with that, but for this particular case, and honestly, I think this is a common use case, people watching video on their iPads. Whether or not they have a keyboard attached, I think that's probably more narrow interest for people who want to use it for productivity. But people watching video is common. And that's another reason that the landscape camera is important, because people are watching video, I would imagine, mostly in landscape. I don't think people are blowing up the TikTok app to 2x and watching everything vertically on it. So the landscape camera helps with the people who use it as a mini TV. I cover that stupid camera with my hand all the time. It's annoying. And the screen. It's basically a big screen, and it'll be an amazing screen. And then the other thing about the Guts, which is fascinating but less so for what it says about the iPad and more so for what it says about all their other products, is the M4 rumor. You would think this is going to be an iPad Pro with an M3 in it. That would make perfect sense. The MacBook Airs just came out with the M3. The M3's been out for a while. Put it in an iPad, sure. But the rumor is, oh, but it might be an M4. And it's like, okay, well, maybe. I will see. But that rumor has heated up recently with actual evidence. There was two sets of evidence. I've meant to grab this one from a screenshot. One of them was the part number for the CPU. And Apple has these weird internal part numbers. Like the M2 was T8112. And the M3 was T8122. So the third number, or the fourth digit, fourth character is changing. So T811, T812. You would expect that the M3 is T8122. But the rumor, the people trying to find like things in the OS or whatever, says that this new upcoming iPad is T813. I know it's confusing because one is the M2 and two is the M3.
It's made on the A16 process for the,
exactly
for the 11-inch
right.
iPad for Mac,
but anyway,
iPad OS 17.
The part number, if they follow the same pattern, the part number says it's an M4. And the other thing is that the product number, there's sort of internal product numbers that Apple has for its devices, and it's like always like a name of a product, then number, comma, another number. And the rumored part numbers, again, pulled out of iPad OS 7.5 beta, is iPad 16.3, 16.4, 16.5, and 16.6, right? So the iPad Air 5 was, and the iPad Pro from 2020 were labeled iPad 13, comma something, and they have the M1. And all the iPads that have the M2 are labeled iPad 14. So M1 is 13, M2 is 14,
oh, so they
M3 would be 15. But this is iPad 16, so they're skipping iPad 15, which would have been the M3 model, and that leads more evidence to this being the M4. So all of the internal software dredged out part numbers and product numbers lead to the conclusion that the iPad Pro will have an M4 in it and not an M3.
I find this so hard to believe, and if it wasn't for this, like, 16, comma, whatever, whatever, I think I would say absolutely not, but this whole part number thing or model number thing is really giving me pause.
And the part number thing, because the part number is even more obscure. Those like T8, whatever, like that's super obscure. Like what? There'd be no reason to like fake that or skip a number in that. That's really even farther, you know, to dig that out. But yeah, it's consistent. They skipped over the M3 thing, and this looks like it's going to have an M4 in it. And I find it perfectly plausible because we know that every M3 whatever chip that Apple has made has been on the N3B process, which is super expensive and essentially Apple exclusive. And Apple kind of had to do it if they wanted to get their products out the door, right? But they don't want to stick with it for any longer than they have to. And so if TSMC can make M4s in time to be in the iPad Pro, you bet Apple would love to not have to pay to make another super expensive N3B-based product. And I think it is plausible that you can announce something on May 7th with an M14 in it. I'm not sure when it will ship, but, you know, TSMC doesn't always publicly say when they're doing all, you know. So I think it is plausible. I think it's plausible based on the part numbers. I think it's plausible based on the timing. But it's super interesting because that would mean that the M4, all the rumors about the M4 lineup and how, like, by the end of next year, every single Mac will be on something on the M4. That gets a lot more likely to happen if they're starting with the M4s in May, right? Not even WWDC. And then what that means also is that for WWDC, if they release an M4 iPad, I don't care about the M4, right? Who cares? Like, I think the iPad is plenty, you know, I don't care about it in the iPad, right? But what that means is come WWDC, if they announce any Mac hardware, doesn't that also have to have the M4? Or maybe not. Maybe they just announce the M3 Ultra. Like, I just, this overlap in these numbers is killing me. I just really wish they would get on schedule and just make the number go up by one every once in a while. But I will be unrealistically expecting M4-based Macs at WWDC if they release an M4-based iPad Pro. But I think the M4-based iPad Pro is plausible. And so now, honestly, now I expect it.
That it, and oh. and like German's traffic record's been pretty good about this kind of stuff recently, and he's pretty sure about it from his sourcing. So like, it's looking like this is a real possibility, and you know, to some degree, like we don't know how big of an update the M4 is compared to the M3. Like, you know, John mentioned, like, there is this process switch thing, you know, with, you know, N3B, as we discussed, was kind of a dead end with TSMC's processing. It was this very expensive process, and that's what the M3 and all of last fall's phone chips were made on. And so it's probably, like, if I had to guess, if the M4 is ready this soon after the M3, my guess is the M4 was largely a change to get off that process and to be on the new, you know, N3, whatever the, what's the new one, N3P?
N3E. And keep in mind, N3E is essentially, it's worse in terms of the product you get, but it's better in terms of yield and cost.
Yes,
so
exactly.
N3B is like the super expensive, but it actually is slightly better, but like no one wants to pay for it and the yields are terrible, right? So Apple wants to get off of that. Everyone wants to get off of it as soon as possible, but not because N3E is fantastically better. Like it is the same or even potentially slightly worse, but cheaper, better yields, and so that makes sense. And I think the M4 advances over the M3. I assume, like, whatever they do with the neural engine, or if they rebrand it, or whatever AI mumbo jumbo, like, that could possibly be in there. But I mean, I don't think it's just a warmed over M3, because the thing about N3E is it's not, whatever the term is, it's not compatible with the designs they did for N3B. So you have to essentially relay out the chip. So I think it will be more of its own device than we might imagine, because it's not like they can just take the exact layout of the M3 and stamp it in M3E. They can't do that. That's the whole deal with M3B, right? So what that if this is the start of the M4s and there are no more M3s, it would mean the M3s were like, we had to get something out the door. We used the most expensive process that no one else wanted to pay for, and we did a whole bunch of chips all at once, and we got off it as fast as we can. But if, on the other hand, WWDC comes and they've introduced an M4 iPad Pro and they say, and now here's the new M3 Ultra Mac Studio, I'm going to be like, what are you doing, Apple? what's going on? What, like, an N3B, how expensive would an N3B-based M3 Ultra chip be? And, it'll be faster than a plain M4, that's for sure, but it's so weird. So it's so strange to be launching this on the iPad, because who has an iPad who's like, boy, this needs an M4? Like, no one is thinking that. They're thinking it needs a better OS, it needs a better keyboard, to Marco's point. Maybe they want more pencil features, which we'll get to in a little bit.
I have some theories. All right, so think about it. If you look at the rumors overall between last fall and now about things like the process node switch, how N3B is so expensive and it's kind of a dead end, I'm guessing... And we were saying this all last fall. As you were saying, Apple wants to get off of that process quickly, that the M3 and the A, whatever we're on for the phones, that this, like, there's a reason why this year only the Pro phones got the new A chip with the 3-nanometer process on the N3B, and the other phones didn't. And then keep in mind, we've already for months heard the rumors that this coming fall's iPhones are both going to get a new chip. So it's not going to continue that lag of, like, you know, the cheaper phone has last year's chip. That's been the rumor for months, that that's not happening this year, which means that the iPhone chips that were made this past fall are one-offs, because Apple does not keep making the Pro phones for the next year. So the whatever A we're on now is a one-off chip, it seems. It's not going to go to next year's cheaper phone. So that's out. That, like, after this coming fall, when Apple stops making the iPhone, what the hell, we are 15? There's so many numbers. So when Apple stops making the iPhone 15 Pros this September, that chip is gone. It's not in anything else. It's not going into cheaper products. Okay, that's one of the chips out of the way. Then we have the M3 generation. Well, it sure looks like, we've heard rumors so far, and it sure looks like, just based on timing, that there might not be an M3-based Mac Studio. So that product is probably not getting it. So we're really looking at what's going to be left with the N3B process chips, which are the M3, M3 Pro, M3 Max, and A, whatever is on the phone. It's just going to be then the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro. And those both get updated pretty much every year to every chip that comes out for them. So, whereas the iPad,
the iMac,
and the iMac, right? Oh yeah, that's okay. That's interesting. But anyway, so the iPad Pro gets updated less frequently. It doesn't get every chip. It sometimes skips them, as it might be about to. And so maybe what they're looking to do here is jump the iPad Pro forward first, because then they can keep making that for the next 2 years, not touch it, and not have any chips left on the expensive N3B process. So my guess is they were okay using N3B for the really important high-end products that needed 3-nanometer to get ahead, stay competitive, and that's the iPhone Pro, the MacBook Pro, and the MacBook Air. But then they're going to move off of that as quickly as they can. And the products that have longer refresh cycles are kind of less important, like the Mac Mini, the Mac Studio, and the iPad Pro. Maybe they don't
and
get
the
it.
iMac, unfortunately.
Yeah, the iMac's also, the one weird one. That's but you know, maybe.
But I think I don't
that,
think it's that
you know,
weird
with
because
the,
they
with
skipped
the MacBook Air.
Yeah, they skipped with the iMac, so it was overdue. I think the iMac will move to M4 quickly. Like, I don't think the M3 iMac is going to be around for 4 years. I think they're going to move that to the M4 as quick, quicker than we think, but we'll see.
Yeah, and so based on that, like, if we go with the theory that the M4 is something that Apple is trying to get out there as quickly as possible to minimize the amount of time they need to keep making N3B chip products, then it does make sense to put it in the iPad Pro now. And also, I would also then simultaneously not have massive expectations for the M4 over the M3, because the M3 was already a big jump over the M2, and it's only been out for like 2 seconds. So I'm guessing everything we're hearing about, like the M4 having a significant focus on AI, I'm guessing that's probably going to be mostly a marketing focus, which is fine. Like, Apple should be leaning into this. Everyone else is, and they look like they're behind. So they should be leaning into AI as a marketing thing. Their chips already are good at many AI-related tasks. They're already good at running inference. They're already good at training. They already have good GPUs, good neural engines, you know, lots of fast memory. So, like, they're already good at all that stuff. So for them to say, the M4 is great for AI, like, yeah, that's because all of their chips are pretty good for that relative to other consumer product chips. So they can still say all that while the M4 doesn't necessarily need to be a major jump forward. So I think we're going to see everything move to the M4 as quickly as possible, possibly even all in this calendar year. We'll see.
Well, the problem is the rumors for like the good beefy M4 chips for like the Studio and Mac Pro are like well out into next year. And so that really puts cold water on my idea that there's going to be a Mac Studio announcement at WWDC with an M4 in it. Yeah. But I mean, obviously, I mean, Apple wants it's not a question of them like deciding to do this. They need the M4 to be available. If the M4 wasn't available, they wouldn't do this. But if it is available, yes, they're jumping on it ASAP. And that's why I think they'll also update the iMac. Because as soon as the M4 is available, with a reasonable upgrade cycle, they're going to, like, we got to get, to your point, get everything off of N3B. Any products we sell with N3Bs in them, they're not going to get any cheaper. No one else is using that process. TSMC is probably going to stop making it as soon as we're done buying it from them. So let's get off of it. And so any product that was on it, we need to get it off within the next calendar year, right? And this being the first product is like, well, we're making a new iPad and this is available. So by all means, let's not put the M3 in it. And yeah, then it gives them more runway to let this, I'm going to say let this languish, but not, it's not going to languish. Like, again, the computing power is not the thing that is holding this back. And this will be presumably the new design with the new pencil and the new camera orientation and no holes in the bottom. Sorry, Marco, although I guess we'll do the pencil next. The rumor of this pencil is it's the Apple Pencil 3. The Apple did just come out with a new pencil, but that one wasn't like the good pencil, the top end one, the most expensive pencil. This is the new most expensive pencil. And how can you tell? A, it'll be more expensive. And B, it has new features. And the rumored features are a squeeze function. Because, yeah, sure. Like, I mean, you could also do a button Apple, but that's so unseemly. So a squeeze function. And haptic feedback in the pencil of some kind. Maybe that's just in response to your squeeze. Maybe it'll be like a rumble feature to make it feel like textured paper or something. Who knows? But the pencil continues to get increasingly fancy. I think the rumors are that it will still be flat-sided. It will still attach magnetically. It'll be a little bit shorter than the old one, maybe to fit in wherever they're going to slap it on. Maybe it'll go on the short side this time as more of a landscape, you know, landscape-oriented iPad type thing where the camera's on the top and the pencil's on the side. You know, that's reasonable. And then your one hope this year, Marco, is the rumors of a more, quote, laptop-like aluminum Magic Keyboard and trackpad. I don't think it's going to attach with holes, but I think it will be, well, to help Casey and his poor worn out, you know, to help everybody with their poor worn out iPad keyboards that are made of whatever fabric or rubbery membrane or whatever. If you make the thing out of aluminum and plastic, just like the laptops, it will wear like the laptops do, which is better than these iPad things. Bigger trackpad, maybe a glass trackpad. If it's made of aluminum, it can be more structurally sturdy. They still have the problem of most of the weight being in the screen part, sort of being the inverse of a laptop, where laptops, the screen is light and the base is heavy, and that works out for a, you know, a simple rear hinge. They don't have that on the iPad, so they got to do some sort of cantilevering thing. But for people who do want a more laptop-like experience out of their iPad, the rumors are that Apple is going to deliver that.
Yeah, I so first of all, just back to the pencil for a second. The double tap gesture to like change tools or go to the eraser on the pencil has always been a little finicky and a little bit like it's easy to accidentally trigger it. And so
excuse me, that is not fair. It is so frustratingly difficult to get right.
Really?
So
I've always found it triggers accidentally.
Well, yeah, it's either that's the thing. You're either doing it when you don't want to or completely freaking unable to do it when you do want to.
Right.
It's so very frustrating.
So, like, I assume that double tap gesture will be replaced by whatever form this, like, haptic squeeze possible button thing is. And if so, that's great, because that needed to be rethought. So
Do you think it'll replace it or be an addition to it?
Oh, that's a good question. I hope it replaces it directly, because
I mean,
it
replaced
it
in the AirPods. There's that precedent, right?
Yeah.
AirPods used to be tap, and now they're squeeze.
Yes, but the AirPods don't have haptic feedback. They play a click sound. So, like, they give you feedback, but it's audio feedback, not like, vibration feedback. So we'll see. I mean, you know,
what is audio but vibrations?
Wow. Fair.
Well done.
You know, if you look, like, there were rumors last fall about the iPhones getting basically like non-moving buttons that would provide haptic feedback, so they would feel like buttons but they wouldn't actually be moving. Maybe they are using whatever tech that was that didn't make it into last year's iPhones. Maybe that's what this is in the pencil. That's not like I've been much more skeptical about that stuff in the past. I think Apple has shown over time that when they actually try to make a haptic button that is supposed to behave and feel like a button, they usually do a pretty good job. You know, you had like the haptic home screen, or the home buttons on the iPhone 7 and forward, and you know, those actually felt pretty good. They felt like buttons. You know,
the trackpads.
Yeah, the clicking trackpads. Like when they actually attempt to make something look and or feel and work like a button, they usually do a good job of it recently. So if that's what they're doing, I have high hopes that it will probably be decent. And so my major pencil question marks are basically how the heck it will attach and charge and where it will attach and charge to the iPad.
Because and battery life.
Honestly, I think the battery life is pretty good.
Right, but now they're going to put a motor in there, like the taptic engine.
That's fair. I mean, it would probably be pretty tiny, and you're not basically feeling it constantly. Like it would only be anyway. I wouldn't worry too much about that. My main concern is where does it go on the iPad? How does it attach? How does it charge? And do they give it some kind of, you know, nice button feel or button effect for that? That would be great. I thought about Casey. I thought about whether they would put it on the short side, but. I don't know. Like, you got to figure out like where are the speakers going.
Yeah, it is supposed to be shorter though. Regardless of which side it's on, the rumor is that it is slightly shorter than the Apple Pencil 2.
Yeah, so we'll see. Somebody, I forget where I saw this. Somewhere on Mastodon, I think. Somebody was saying like, wouldn't it be great if this also worked with future iPhones? And yeah, that would be amazing. it would not be small enough to magnetically attach to an iPhone, but. I don't know. I honestly would love something like that for iPhones. But the problem also with that is that if you've noticed, recent iPads that are compatible with the Pencil get really fingerprinty, way more than your phone. And the reason why is because the phone's oleophobic coating apparently gets worn away if you would use it on the iPad for the Pencil. So when iPads became Pencil compatible, they actually had to switch to a worse oleophobic coating on the glass, and that's why modern iPads get so incredibly fingerprinty so easily. But anyway, so back to the iPad. Those are my wishes for the Pencil. I would love for it to have some kind of physical attachment mechanism that was not just magnets that actually would stay there, but I'm not super confident in that. So in the absence of that, yeah, give me a haptic button, sure.
Third-party opportunity. There's lots of cases with little loops and latches and pockets and things for you to stick your pencil in. That seems to be Apple's solution to this problem, is it attaches with a magnet. If you don't jostle it too much, if you want to travel with it, buy one of those cases where you can stick it in a little holster or loop or whatever.
By the way, Casey just messaged me saying his computer kernel panicked and he's rebooting. So
kernel panicked.
You think it's third-party RAM? Have we used that joke too much?
I don't know. You should see the panic report. Watchdog says didn't hear back from whatever panic. Yeah, that's, I guess, the last one I got. Can't remember. It was a while ago. Well, while he's gone, we can talk about the one other rumor, which is the iPad Air. So the iPad Air is rumored there's going to be a big iPad Air, which I think is nice. Like, in the same way that there's the big iPhone, like the Plus phone, there should be a big but not super expensive iPad. So a 12.9-inch iPad Air, which sounds good to me, with an M2 in it. And I think, I don't have it in front of me, but I think the rumor is that the big iPad Pro is now going to be 13 inches instead of 12.9. Whoa. I'm assuming that mostly just has to do with the screens that they have available. Or maybe they just decided to make it 0.1 inch bigger. So there you go. I mean, I think this is my Apple event of the year. Oh, I guess, no, yeah. Well, no, September, I guess.
Yeah, they're probably not giving you your Mac Pro this year.
No, I know. So, like, it's this and the phone, because this is my year for the phone. So, yeah, when I'm getting, if this iPad has an OLED, I'm getting it, 100%. The only question is I have to decide how much storage I'm going to put in it or whatever. And I'm probably not going to get cellular, because I haven't used cellular on iPad in ages. But I'm excited. Apple's going to announce a product that I'm actually going to buy. All that money I saved by not buying the Vision Pro, well, some of it's going to go bye-bye when they announce this thing.
I wonder, too, with the iPad Air rumor about the big one, That made so much sense to us before they announced the iPhone Plus and the 15-inch MacBook Air. But it has seemed from various reports that those products haven't actually been selling very well.
Well, this is what I always say. What I say to Apple, if anyone said it to me, every product can't be your best-selling product. You can make products that don't sell as well as other ones.
All right,
you're sure. A huge company. Make a big MacBook Air. No, it's not going to sell as well as the 13-inch. The 13-inch is the size most people want, which is why it was the only one you made. But some people want it with 15. Just keep making it. It's not that hard to do. If they sold, if it was, 99.99% 13-inch, okay, maybe they'll make the 15-inch. But it's not. It's a single-digit percentage. Keep making it. I say the same thing about the big iPad Air. Just make it. It's like, oh, we don't. So, do you want it to be 50-50? What percentage does it have to be? It's like, it's only 5%. That's fine. 5% should justify it. It's like, well, it's not cost effective. But just sometimes you have to make a diversified product line, and sometimes the popular one helps fund the less popular one just so you can have more happy customers. That's my pitch to Apple for every single product, including the iPhone Mini, the big iPad Air, the 15-inch MacBook Pro, like all of these things. They can't all be your best seller. It's never going to be divided up exactly evenly between the models that you field. One of them is always going to be way more popular, and there's always going to be one that's the least popular. I'm not saying you make 17 different sizes of phone, but you can make 3. And I'm not saying you make 20 different sizes of iPad, but you can make 3. That's my pitch.
All right. Casey's having continued problems. We should maybe... He needs one more minute.
I thought he was back in IRC.
And then he popped right back out.
did he get another kernel panic?
No, he says that he's having some issues with the computer now recognizing the audio device, because it's a hardware recorder and it's been recording the whole time. So I'm thinking maybe maybe it won't use USB mode when it's already recording, but we're working on that. In the meantime, I guess you and I can talk about, do we want to do Ask ATP?
Yeah, Ask ATP is next up, I think.
Okay, so we'll do that next once Casey gets back here. So, hi, everybody. Hope you enjoyed my fish in the pre-show. I know John did.
No, I mercifully, one of the benefits of being a host of the show is you don't have to hear it. When I join the call, I hear nothing. People go into the live chat room, you hear fish, but I hear nothing. I just joined the Zoom room. Fish is not playing in the Zoom room. I shouldn't give Marco any ideas.
The real tragedy is that as soon as I start the live stream, I also don't hear fish.
Yeah, there you go.
Because Audio Hijack captures it, and I guess I know there's an option somewhere to like pass it back through. But I just don't have it turned on. But
it's part of the live experience. One of the things about live experiences, fish is selling your recordings notwithstanding, is that the live experience is it happens when it happens, and you're either there for it or you're not, and then it ends. And yes, someone can record it, and so on and so forth. But I feel like it's like the same thing with the chat room and the live stream. The live stream happens. And you could record it if you wanted, but you know, being there live is a singular experience, and it is fleeting, and that's what makes it valuable. So, enjoy the fish, the brief fish that you must endure to get to the live stream.
It is the only. It is the briefest of fish, you know, compared to most people's experiences of this band. The 15 minutes before the show, that I do, for the record, I do plan out what plays so that. What's playing right before we get on usually is near a song boundary and usually is a good, like, you know, ramp up to a good jam or something like that. I actually plan that out. No,
it's like a DJ carefully planning a playlist for you, only it's one band all the time.
Yes, being planned by a terrible DJ.
It's the fish station, all fish all the time for a decade.
They have those. Like, there's one on Sirius XM. There is
a
fish station.
I'm sure. No, hasn't played a repeat yet.
I mean, maybe. They might not have had to. They've been around a long time. They've made a lot of music.
Is Casey on his old computer or his new one? What is he?
I believe it's the third-party RAM. It must be the old iMac Pro. Or no, wasn't it before the iMac Pro? Wasn't it the?
I thought, did he get rid of
the 5K
no,
iMac,
iMac Pro?
That?
He's using like five K displays. He's
yeah,
got
yeah,
that kind
now,
of cool...
yeah, yeah. Now it's all Apple Silicon, but yeah.
All right,
you back? He says he can't hear us.
He can't hear us now.
Oh my god. Oh, this is great.
Casey.
So,
tune in to the after show for more fish.
Yeah, there's going to be probably at least 10 minutes of fish talk in the after show. Oh my god,
it's going to be more than that, I'm sure.
So why do you think he kernel panicked in the middle of a podcast on Apple Silicon?
Like I said, there's the thing, the last like three kernel panics I've got over the past maybe 2 years have all said like there's like some kind of watchdog thing that it's like if it doesn't get a check-in from some other part of the system, it panics essentially. And that's always at the top of the trace. I don't know if that means anything. It could just be like that's how the panic is detected. Like the watchdog did not get a check-in after some amount of time, and it panicked. And why didn't it get a check-in? Maybe something crashed or whatever. I can never make heads or tails of the things, but that's probably the top of the panic report. That's my guess. What does that mean? I don't know. I mean, I've always chalked it up to software bugs. It's not like it's an ongoing problem or getting worse or whatever. It's just, you know, maybe 1.5 times per year if it happens. And keep in mind that I never shut down my computer. So I usually have a roundabout, you know, well, my uptime is not that good because I have to do OS updates. But setting aside OS updates, kernel panic is the only time I restart my computer. And I can't remember the last time I had one. Maybe it wasn't. I don't think I've had one this year. Maybe in the middle of last year sometime.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
So I thought to myself, self, should you restart your computer before you record? You got out of that habit because you didn't need to anymore.
Just got done saying I don't restart my computer ever.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah. And I used to do it religiously when I had my iMac Pro, or maybe it was the iMac that never, ever friggin' worked. And I thought, no, it's only been up a week. It's fine.
The only rule I have is I do not do an OS update the day before we record. But that is my only rule for computer hygiene for recording.
I'm so very sorry. This is going to make for an interesting bootleg.
Do you have the panic report?
Hold on. Wait, actually, I haven't even started recording. Holy shitballs. Hold on.
Oh, my God. Start recording.
All right. I'm recording now. Oh, God. Do I have the what now?
The panic report.
Where do I get that? Now console.
It came up on your screen in a big window.
Oh, no. I already cleared it in a haste to just get back the hell on the phone.
It's somewhere in logs, but I can never find it these days. The console app makes everything so hard to find.
But my computer was restarted because of a problem. I can tell you that.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Very passive.
I'm so sorry, y'all.
This
I don't
is on
even
your
know
laptop,
what the hell.
Right? It
is my laptop.
Figure out which computer to blame.
No, it's my laptop. I don't know what the hell happened. I wasn't doing anything unusual or weird. It's just all of a sudden, like I couldn't click my magic trackpad, and then it's like, oh no, oh no, oh no, and then pink screens, and then dead. Well, no, I'm sorry. It's pink screens, screaming fan, dead, rebooted.
Nice.
Yeah, stupendous. I'm sorry, y'all. That's very unprofessional of me. I mean, obviously it wasn't deliberate, but very unprofessional. I apologize.
We decided we're going to do Ask ATP, unless you have thoughts on the iPad Air.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Let's just go right to Ask ATP. Also, you're going to have 17 different files, Mark.
As long as I have you recorded, I can make sense of it. It's fine.
Yeah, well, I was trying so desperately not to kill the backup recording on the hardware, and you were right that I needed to stop the recording. And
did he just leave again?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God.
What is it? I'm thinking, like, did he install something recently?
Still nothing.
Oh, there you are. You're back. Wait, you...
What?
You disappeared for, like, 17 seconds.
You cut out totally for, like, yeah.
Holy balls.
I'm glad to hear you're still here.
Yeah, well, I am still here. Well, anyways.
Everything's
fine,
I'm sure.
The point is, everything's just great. So then I, you know, turned off the USB pre, and then I was like, oh, sure, yes, okay, I'll stop recording and be done now. But I was trying desperately, that's why it took a little longer, I was desperately trying to not make this an awful edit for you, and it turns out it didn't work out.
It'll be fine.
I'm so sorry. Anyway, all right, let's do some Ask ATP. And Charlie Sorrell writes, years and years ago, when
he cut out again. Mm-hmm. Do you think he knows? Can he hear us?
No.
Are both sides are cutting out? That can't be good. I think this has never happened. We've never had like this big of a technical problem, have we?
Oh no! Did I lose you again?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I don't know whether to blame that on your computer or Zoom or what. Did you hear us talking while you were talking?
No, I couldn't hear a thing.
So I would maybe consider the possibility that you aren't being recorded during that time either, and that concerns me.
I mean, I see the... I'm not arguing with you, but everything looks to me on my end like I'm recording. So do you want me to like quit the Zoom chat or something?
Let's see.
Or do you want me to reboot
again? Stop audio hijack recording, open up the file, listen to yourself, see if you cut out.
Is there another computer you can use? Do you have like a laptop?
Not quickly and easily, no.
Hmm.
I mean, it's fine. I'm sure it'll be fine. It'll be great. I mean, I'm seeing, all kidding aside, I'm seeing meters everywhere dancing consistently. So,
all right, as long as you, like, if you're recording on the Mix Pre, has the meters going, then yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. The problem is just content-wise, if you can't hear us and we can't hear you chunks of time, it's going to make for a weird
show.
We're
hearing him perfectly now. It's just when he starts an Ask ATP question, it cuts out.
All right, so hold on. You know what I'm going to do? Hold on. Bear with me. I usually just leave Wi-Fi on because why would it hurt? But I'm going to turn it off. Right. Nah.
Were we back to, are you on Wi-Fi?
What year is this? Oh my God.
All right, well, are you still there, Casey? As you turn off Wi-Fi, is your Ethernet cable connected to anything? Don't turn off Wi-Fi.
There's two Caseys in Zoom now. Oh my God. This is a mess.
How is there two?
I'm going to try kicking out the other remove.
Hello.
I only see one.
I see two.
Wait, if I remove you, it says you can't rejoin.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, just leave it. It's fine.
I'll put fake Casey in the waiting room.
I'm still here. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
All right. So I am perhaps because I mean I don't know how Wi-Fi could be weird. I'm literally 4 feet from the friggin' main access point. But you know, one
Wi-Fi can always
about.
Be weird. That is the rule of Wi-Fi for podcasters. It can always has the potential to be weird. Wait, can you hear us now?
You should open Activity Monitor and see.
God,
something jumping up.
There I am again. Hello,
right,
I'm
hi.
Back.
What was that?
I don't know. All of a sudden, you just stopped. Like I could see on my internet.
He's out again. Oh my God! We have to try something else.
All right, hold on. You know what? I'm gonna fucking.
Oh my God! This is terrible. Well, I for somebody out there, this is going to be the first bootleg they hear.
Yeah. Enjoy.
Yeah. It's not normally like this if you're that person. Sorry. Oh, my God. All right. So I guess now what?
Well, when he comes back, we'll try to we'll discuss options with him before he disappears again. Because we do get these brief periods where we can talk.
I mean, we have other forms of, you know, other ways we can reach him. Oh my God! All right, now he's actually left the Zoom.
Well, that's good.
I assume he's like rebooting or something. I don't know what. What do you think is the next thing he's going to drop on us? Like, you know, one who's like, you know, oh, it turns out I have Wi-Fi on. Like, what do you think is the next thing? Like, you know, oh, by the way, like, you know, I'm on a boat.
I did just install this kernel extension. Like, I don't know. Like, I am running Docker in the background while we record.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go.
I don't know what it could be. Like, I'm trying to think what has changed.
Hi again.
Hey.
Jesus. So now I'm tethered because I'm just sick of dealing with any of this because I don't know what else to do. I don't know what is being so wonky right now, but hopefully this will be better. Maybe.
All right.
Possibly.
I mean, it didn't seem like an internet connection issue, but I mean, hey, you never know. Let's try it.
You never know. Right. I mean, I have no idea what else to try, so I'm just going to go with this.
Is your phone plugged in?
Yes, it's physically plugged in directly to my Mac, not through a hub of any sort. Directly to my Mac.
Is your phone
I just
want to
make
Wi-Fi?
Sure the phone is powered.
Yes, it is powered. It is not on Wi-Fi because I'm tethering.
You're recording. Are your meters going up and down?
Yes, meters are down. I mean, I'm not offended. Sorry, I sounded like I was offended. I'm not offended. I can restart recordings. I don't see any reason why I should need to because everything's. I'm looking at it all. Everything's bouncing up and down.
All right, you should be okay as long as the MixPre has the hardware recording. Oh, that's always a good fallback.
Yeah, your audio quality in the bootleg is going to be even worse, but it's better if you don't cut out.
Yeah, and you haven't cut out yet since making that switch. So let's give it a shot.
I don't know.
So.
I genuinely don't know what's going on, but I'm not here for this. I'm so sorry, everybody. This is a train wreck upon
just
train wreck.
If your
sorry,
Mac had
let's
cellular,
just... right?
That would have been
thank
easier.
You. It would have been so much.
It'd
better.
Be another right. part of the system to kernel panic.
That's true. That's also fair. All right, let's do some Ask ATP. Charlie Sorrell writes, years and years ago when Marco was still child-free, Casey told Marco that once he became a dad, he'd give up making fancy coffee. I think it was AeroPress at the time. That was a while ago now, obviously. What actually happened? You know, I 100% believe I did this because this is huge Casey energy, but damned if I remember having this conversation.
Shocking that you don't remember something that happened years ago.
Exactly, exactly. So what's the story there, Marco?
So it turns out you were kind of right.
I'm actually very surprised by this, to be honest.
So I no longer roast my own beans. I actually gave away my roaster in a recent like garage sale thing. I never ended up roasting at the beach because it was not a great setting for it. Like, you know, when you roast, there's a whole bunch of like smoke and stuff you have to deal with. And the beach setup was just really not a good environment for that. What happened in those years, like when I moved to the beach in, you know, early COVID times, that was also the time when like mail order coffee was already really good by that point. Like I was already getting what used to be called Tonks and is now called Yes Please. I was getting a sponsor of this episode. What the hell is it called? I just recorded this. Oh God.
Trade Coffee.
Trade, yes. I was getting sponsor of this episode, Trade, you know, shipped to me. And so I had these wonderful mail order options. And what also happened around that same time was that my taste in coffee shifted towards more medium and light roasts. And medium and light roasts are more difficult to do, especially on a home roaster. Because home roasters, they're much smaller batches. They roast much more quickly. And it's kind of like microwaving popcorn, where like there's certain cracks and pops that the beans make at different stages. And if you're making a very small amount of coffee, it can be very difficult to time very precisely. Like, all right, now it's done enough. I'm going to stop the roast now. And you know, when big coffee shops are roasting, they're doing much larger batches with much larger roasters, and they generally have more control over it. As a result, as you know, it's more thermal mass. It rises more evenly and more slowly. But when you're doing home roasting, it's hard to make a really good light or medium roast and to actually really nail it. So my roasting skills were really not up for making that style of coffee. And because I was never that good of a home roaster. I was an okay home roaster. So my home roasting kind of fell off and I stopped doing it. And I just switched to mail order. And that got me through most of COVID, all of COVID. More recently, it's actually gotten a little bit worse because in the new house, I'm still living in a construction zone here, There's still, like, you know, paper on the floors. There's like coverings on the countertops. They're still doing like some painting and wall work. So there's still dust being produced here and there, you know, tile being put up and stuff like that. And so I haven't really wanted to, like, first of all, there are many days where I just, like, can't even get into the kitchen, or like the sink will have a drop cloth over it because they're working above it or something. That was going on today. So what I've been doing mostly is just going to the coffee shop in town. And just getting coffee like twice a day at the coffee shop, just driving it down, picking it up. Or if I'm not able to do that, or, you know, the weather's bad or I'm not here, I've often just been doing frozen coffee pods. There's a company called Cometeer that also, they make really good frozen pods. And I love them. They're fantastic. And I wouldn't recommend it for every day because it's a little bit over the top, you know, having these like frozen pods that you have to get shipped to you, and you know, the per cup cost is way higher than bean cost and everything. But if you don't have a coffee maker or an AeroPress nearby to use, if you just need to like make some coffee without pretty much any equipment except maybe a hot water kettle, it's a great way to do it. And honestly, the coffee that I get from Cometeer is better than anything I've ever home roasted. It's really good. So this, you know, this is not an ad for Cometeer. They're not sponsoring, etc. But so all that is to say, I have largely stopped. I've completely stopped roasting my own beans, which I used to do regularly for years. I have partially stopped even making my own coffee and brewing my own coffee at home, because I just haven't had like a reliable kitchen set up a lot of the time for the last few months. And so I assume I will get back into at least the brewing part more. You know, once things calm down here and I actually have a kitchen that is not full of dust that I can actually use reliably, I expect to get back into brewing my own coffee and getting, and, you know, remaining good at that. But I'm actually further from it now than I've ever been. And that was mostly because mail order services got really good, and also Cometeer kind of ruined me because it's really good too.
Doesn't sound like any of it was kid related though.
No, well, not really. No, because like, I mean, really, you know, my kid just turned 12, and I was roasting my own coffee until he was about 8, and brewing my own coffee until he was 11. So, you know, I don't think it was kid related. I think it's just like, you know, kind of old person reality,
aging
busyness,
related, yeah.
Yeah, business related and aging related. Like, you know, my taste shifted towards something I don't make very well, light roasts, and other options for that taste became available that were really good. You still here, Casey?
Andy writes, after years of trying, I finally got an invitation. What? Hi? Hello?
Sorry, you super duper roboted. It's fine.
Go ahead.
Can you just keep going.
No, now we can't.
Are you messing with me right now?
No.
Please tell me you're messing with me.
you just like super
roboted. You wait till you hear this in the bootleg. It'll be great.
Yeah, your punishment is you're going to have to listen to the bootleg.
See, now I can barely hear you. Seriously.
That was way better
Andy
than the
writes,
dropout.
After...
Oh, now we have latency.
Okay, well, we'll go with that.
All right.
Oh, hello. Hello. Can you hear me at all?
Yes.
Jesus, yes, we can. Fuck.
Just proceed.
Okay, good. All right. Andy writes, after years of trying, I finally got an invitation to attend WWDC. I hope you guys will cover the what to do or not to do at WWDC, as I've been told that you've done in the past. Even a pointer to which episodes I should listen to would be extremely helpful. I don't feel like I can be of help at all, because last time I was at WWDC was in San Jose. So, Marco, tell us about this.
So one thing to note, Andy, is that the WWDC experience today and for the last couple of years that it's been at Apple Park is very different from what it was in the past, where it was like at a conference center and it was a whole week of in-person sessions. So what it is now is all the sessions are virtual, so there's really no in-person component there at all. The only in-person stuff to do now is there's like a big developer event that you were presumably invited to at Apple Park to watch the keynote. So what this is you are sitting in a lawn, like an Apple Park, in front of those giant sliding doors for the cafeteria. You sit in a bunch of chairs set up like, you know, a big outdoor, you know, concert or something. You're in a bunch of chairs out there. Tim Cook comes out on stage, says hello, good morning. And then, you know, you watch the video basically on a giant screen. And then afterwards, you, like, you know, go and you're led over to, like, the, you know, some kind of various events. There's, like, tours and stuff like that. And then there's occasional other stuff around Apple Park for that day and maybe the day after, especially revolving around the Apple Visitor Center, which is, like, it's kind of across the street and has, like, a coffee shop, and it's basically a big Apple store and stuff. So and then there's a handful of other community events that happen. There's things like the live talk show that usually happen there. There's other, like, smaller groups that are arranging things, I mean, certain developer groups and meetup kind of things happening. So this is a very different experience than it used to be, but it's still pretty fun. It's just different. The big thing to keep in mind when you're going there now, first of all, you got to bring sunscreen for the keynote. They usually actually give you, like, little goodie bags that include sunscreen because no one brings it. But if you like a particular kind, bring your own.
They have a roof now over the outdoor people, don't they?
No, they have a roof over some of the outdoor people. That's usually where the press and stuff sit. But then there's still, like, this giant lawn out in front that most of the developers are seated in. And that's,
I thought they had a roof on that too. I thought they did, like, a big structure out on the lawn.
Did they? Am I just forgetting?
I mean, for many years they didn't, but I think the most recent year they put, like, a big tent structure. Anyway, the advice stands: bring sunscreen just in case.
Yeah. Anyway, and so the key thing to know is that what it is now, there is no conference center. So, you know, you're led into the event and you're there, like, you know, in Apple Park. You're obviously, like, you know, very well controlled by Apple people the whole time of, like, where you can go and what you're doing. But then after that, you are escorted, you know, you have the handful of things that day, and then you're escorted out, and then you can't get back in, like, for the rest of the week. So plan, if you're going to be there for, like, a few days, try to plan stuff to do with the other groups and events that happen around that you can actually do without, like, you know, Apple letting you into their campus, because you're just, like, kind of let out into suburban Cupertino. It's like, all right, bye, that's it. You know, it's not like you're not in downtown San Jose anymore or downtown San Francisco, and so there's really no, like, town to hang out in. It's just, like, Apple Park and then the visitor center and then a bunch of houses around you. So the hotel situation is a little, you know, boring or challenging. The, like, you know, dinner and evening event situation is a little limited there. You're basically hanging out in the suburbs next to an office park that won't let you back in. So plan for that with, like, what you expect event wise. If you can get into any of the other, like, side events that are going on, do that. You know, plan for that accordingly. And I honestly wouldn't recommend staying past, you know, like, the events on Monday. I would say you can usually safely leave on at least Wednesday, maybe even Tuesday, you know, depending on whether there's certain events you want to go to. But that's what to expect. Like, it's a really fun presentation that day, but then you're kind of on your own. So plan accordingly.
Wade asks, does it bother you that you have no privacy with public electric charging stations? They know who you are and where you live because of your billing information, what car you drive, where you were when, how far you drove between charges, etc. Is there any practical way to have an electric car not be tracked short of only ever charging it at home? Do you know what the charger operators do with this information? Do they anonymize it? Do they sell it? I mean, I hear you, but I mean, this is the way the world is going. And
it's bad news about credit cards.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't see how there's really any two ways around this. And I'm really struggling to get myself worked up about this, especially since credit cards exist. You know, there's so much data tracking on your phones, which, you know, Apple's doing their best.
I mean, maybe Wade pays with cash at gas stations.
Yeah. You never know. It's possible.
I mean, so there are a couple stories related to this, which are more in the vein of things that are car specific, because knowing where you are and what you're doing, if you use any kind of electronic form of payment, that's sufficient. But the car stuff is like knowing how you drive. And so there are a couple stories. This one is from March of this year. Automakers sharing consumers' driving behavior with insurance companies. That you don't want. I mean,
I especially do not want that, I can assure you.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of the point of insurance. Like, as you slice and dice the insured population into smaller and smaller groups based on the behavior, insurance stops being insurance. The whole point of insurance is you're spreading the risk. So you have to be in a group there has to be variability within a group. If you just put all the high-risk drivers in one group and all low-risk drivers, and like, if you keep slicing it up like that, then everyone should just pay for their own car problems. Like, there's no longer insurance. It's the whole point is you're pooling risk. And so there is the, I mean, it's not really that big of a danger because insurance companies aren't going to be that stupid, but insurance companies do want to adjust the risk pools to their advantage based on knowing exactly how you drive. And that was a controversy in March. And then about 10 days later, General Motors said that they are going to stop sharing their driving behavior with data brokers, right?
So this is good for you.
Yeah, this is the real frontier of privacy in cars. It's not knowing where you go based on paying for charging electric chargers. It is the telemetry gathered while you are driving and where that information goes and what control you have over that information. And that is, I feel like, the more important battlefront. The battle of like trying to find an electric charging station where you can feed $20 bills into a slot, I think that's not going to happen. But yeah, like, again, everywhere you go, if you pay for gas with a credit card or any kind of electronic form of payment, it's not really that much different. And in terms of knowing what you drive, everybody knows what you drive. It's your vehicle's registered. Like, it's not this is all publicly available, or at least information that's available to the people who want to know it. So I would fight for your right to privacy.
Party.
Fight for your right to privacy while you're driving. Like, the actual moment-to-moment information about your driving, even what your trips are, where you go, how long it takes you to get from point A to point B, all that information is being gathered by the car. You just want to legally have some kind of control over it, and hopefully we'll get some laws in that area if we can ever, in this country anyway, if we can ever pass some kind of sweeping privacy, technical electronic privacy legislation, which is... people have been trying to do that for a while, but things move slowly around here, so fingers crossed.
And by the way, like, you know, to the question of specifically like electric fast charging stations, there are fast charging stations out there that are not like profile or login based, that you can just have a credit card, you know, swipe for them. I've never seen one that takes cash, but there are plenty that take credit cards. And so there are options there for, like, you know, less data tracking that you could do, you know, maybe use a certain card for it or whatever. And then there are also ways to charge your car that don't use DC fast chargers. Like, you can charge your car in, like, you know, 220 volt RV plugs. It just, you know, you just have to leave your car overnight somewhere to charge it. So, like, there are options. Like, if you're on a road trip, you can just go to hotels that have those 220 volt chargers and charge overnight every time. Like, that is an option you have. This is not something I would recommend as, like, your only option. But, you know, there are other options, and usually those 220-volt chargers are even less sophisticated. Sometimes it's literally just, like, a plug. Like, you know, it could be, like, one of those Tesla wall units, and, like, there's no login for that. There's no authentication for that. Or it could be, like, a third-party one or a CCS-based one. Like, there's all sorts of them. I mean, geez, there's one in my house. Like, you know, you just have all your trips drive to my house and plug in. Please don't.
But if you pay for that hotel with a credit card, they already know you're there. So
that's yeah. I mean, like, there's so many, you know, if you have like electronic tolling, like, you know, you have like an easy pass in your car, like, that'll tell everybody everything. Like, so there's lots of ways you can be tracked very, 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 very easily for people who actually want to track you. But if you are looking to minimize it, that is something to consider for sure. All right. Thank you to our sponsors this episode, Trade Coffee and Computex 2024. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join atp.fm/join. Our member-only overtime segment this episode, which is our member-only kind of bonus segment, bonus topic after the main show, is going to be about the Limitless Pendant. This is formerly known as the Rewind AI Pendant. It's now called Limitless. We're going to be talking about that in ATP Overtime this week. Join to listen, atp.fm/join. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. So, I feel like I want to do something to my setup to bring it back to what's normal, but I don't want to touch anything.
Don't touch it. You got to ride it out for this show. Then
I know, I'm going to.
You need to spend the next week figuring stuff out.
I don't.
You can run some fiber in your house.
Oh, don't tempt me. Don't tempt me. All right. Let me stop derailing. Marco, you went on a trip. How did it go?
Oh, my God. It was amazing. All right. So so I went, as discussed last episode, I was going to do this. I went to Las Vegas to see Phish play at the Sphere. Oh, my God. So, all right. First of all, I'll get past some technical stuff first. I once again used the AirPods Pro as my concert earplugs, and I had the newest model, the USB-C ones, and I don't know if that matters, probably not, but they were flawless as concert earplugs this time. So there's you know, it's a minor hardware update since the last time I used them, which was last fall or last summer. There's also been there's, you know, iOS 17 came out in the meantime, so there's been some software updates as well to the AirPods. So whatever they have done, if it's changed, or it could just be the way the Sphere does audio, which is kind of advanced and custom and everything. But whatever it is, they were flawless as concert earplugs. There was no, like, weird artifacting like there was last time. There was no, like, variation if I move my head side to side or, like, turn my head like there was last time. It was great. I actually took a picture, which I will make the chapter art for this chapter, of how my watch was reducing the sound, because I the watch measures it and tells you through the AirPods, and so it actually ended up keeping the sound right around 84 decibels, and it was saying, like, the outside world at that time in the concert was, like, in the 90s, like, around 95 decibels. And so with the AirPods, it was bringing it down to about 84 most of the time.
What mode did you have the AirPods in?
So this was the just regular default. I didn't go into any of the accessibility stuff because that alters things in ways that I don't quite want. But just regular AirPods Pro mode. But there's a setting called, hang on a second, I took a screenshot of the setting because I knew I would forget the wording like I always do. 1 minute, where the heck is that picture? Setting, oh, here. There's a setting called Loud Sound Reduction. It's just right in the regular, like the first level AirPods Pro setting screen. Loud Sound Reduction. Everything else, and it was in transparency mode, and everything else was left alone. So with that mode, it seems to keep it around 84 decibels. Now, for reference, earlier today when I was just playing music at like medium to loud volume in my car, just driving around, windows closed, playing medium to loud music in my car, it was around 80-something decibels. It was like, you know, 84, 85, 86 decibels. So, like, it didn't sound quiet. And this isn't something I would recommend that you listen to, like, hours and hours a day or even a week at this level. This is not hearing protection for anybody who needs serious hearing protection. But if you just go to a few concerts a year and you want something to be able to enjoy them with some protection, this still continues to work fantastically. So I strongly can encourage people to try this. I have tried, you know, we've gone over this before. I won't go into it now, but I've tried every concert earplug out there. These are better than all of them in terms of sound quality, clarity, ease of use, even comfort for me. And they don't offer as much protection as like some of the really heavy duty ones, but it's perfectly sufficient for occasional concert goers. Anyway, so what it is like to see a show at the Sphere.
All right, now, before you establish that, can we recap for those who may not be aware what the Sphere is and what the kind of shtick is?
Yeah. So this is a spherical concert venue in Las Vegas. It was only built a couple of years ago. And the gimmick of it, or the innovation of it, there's a whole bunch of innovations of it, but the main one is that the entire like dome of the inside of it is a giant screen, and they can show whatever video content they want on that screen. There's a good video, I'll put it in the show notes, called How Sphere Works, and it's all about like the technical side of like what is the video resolution, how do they capture it, how do they do it, and it's like 16K by 16K square. And it's like, it's absurd. Like, it's tons of custom video. It's actually very interesting. And so if you're interested in like the hardware of this arena, I definitely watch this video. It's not that long. It's pretty interesting. It shows like, you know, what kind of screens they have. And it's basically just a whole bunch of tiny LEDs that, you know, you're just very far from them. So it just looks like a screen. So it's incredible. So what it's like to actually see a concert there. First of all, I can say you need to go see something here because it is impossible to capture what this is like with, you know, a phone camera or whatever. Like, and this is, it's very much like when you hear people try to explain what it's like to watch immersive video in a Vision Pro. And this is a theme I'll come back to. But when you hear like what it's like to be immersed in some kind of like large, you know, your entire field of view environment in Vision Pro, everyone says the same thing, like, oh, you just have to experience it. you can't really like take a picture or video of it and really get what it feels like to be there. And that's exactly what it's like seeing a concert in the Sphere. Like, you can't, it's such an amazing thing. The scale of it is so massive. It's huge, and the screens are far away from you. So what this means, first of all, is that it is incredibly immersive in the sense that it dominates your entire field of view. It goes, you know, depending on where you're sitting, generally goes the entire front field of view in front of you, and straight, like, you can look straight up and you're still looking at video content. And even you can look back somewhat if you're not like in the very back of the place, you can even look back. So it's really all around you. The sound is also really, really good, but, you know, that's kind of the funny thing is, like, they have this like world class sound system in there, and that's almost like incidental to the reason why most people are going to be there, which is the video streams. But it is such an experience to be there. And so one thing that surprised me, first of all, is that the screen of the walls, like the main screen, it is incredibly bright and incredibly sharp. I did not expect that. Like, I was thinking a screen that big, they're going to be doing a lot of like projection and scaling, and I figured it would be kind of dim, and I did not expect it to be very high resolution, and it is neither. Like, it is extremely high resolution and extremely bright, to the point where, like, you know, most concerts, you in the audience are basically sitting in the dark, and, you know, the band's lit up, and occasionally maybe some light will like shine into the crowd or something, but mostly you are sitting in the dark. In the Sphere, the video projection, you know, depending on obviously what they are projecting, but the video content, in Fish's case, was often so bright that it's lighting up the whole place like you're in the living room. Like, so that, first of all, like you're bathed in light because it's just that bright. It is so sharp that whatever they want the content to look like, they can make it look like that. They're like, you don't really see like pixels or, you know, technical details. It's just immersive. It is everything. Sorry to pick on the Vision Pro. It's everything the Vision Pro tries to create and kind of can't with current technology. And this is a, you know, concert arena that cost $2 billion to build. So it's kind of an unfair comparison. it is an amazing effect to be in there. Because the screens are also so far from you, because it's a large venue, they're so far from you that your eyes are effectively at like infinite focus at that point. And so you can create 3D-ish effects, and it doesn't look like you're looking at a flat screen. It can look like you are in a 3D environment pretty well, pretty convincingly, just because it's so far away, you don't perceive like the lack of, you know, parallax or whatever. A few remarks on the audio. It is this like crazy world-class audio system where like they use beamforming to send precise audio to each seat. That's also a thing covered in the video and various articles. It's worth looking up if you care about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that video had a graphic they showed several times that didn't actually go into. I think they were trying to show that different sections of the audience could be hearing things in a different language.
That is
and
something.
I'm
that,
assuming
what?
Yeah, that is something that the Sphere has promoted as like as an ability they have there. Fish didn't do that. Everyone heard the same nonsense. But
right.
there are. There were like, so at certain times they played with, and I think they used it very sparingly for the best, but at certain times they clearly were playing with panning effects where it would seem like one of the instruments was all of a sudden coming from like the far left side of the room and then moved across to the right side of the room and then went back. But, and like, you could tell like they were playing around, and they did it like, I went to two nights and I think I heard that a total of maybe three or four times across the two concerts. So they were using it very sparingly. They also, one of the features of the arena is they call it haptic seats. So first of all, the bass is partially transmitted through the seat speakers. Like, I guess there's speakers along the seats somehow, somewhere. I didn't see them, but maybe they're like, you know, in the floor or whatever. But when you sit down, so, you know, obviously it's a concert, many people are standing most of the time, but like, you know, you get tired and eventually like you might want to sit down for a couple of songs. So first of all, at the Sphere, that's actually a really nice thing to do, because even if the people in front of you are standing so you can't see the band anymore, you can just look up and you can still see most of the video content, even if the people in front of you are standing and you want to sit for a minute. So that
as
alone...
As an old person, this is disappointing to me that people are standing in the sphere. The whole point of the amazing haptic seats and everything, it's like, but no, it's a concert, we have to stand. No, you're all old, just sit. You're in, like, if you can't sit in the sphere, like, it's so clearly like an AV experience. They have the world's most high-tech chairs. Some of the sound is in the chair. Sit in the chairs. I can't believe people were standing. You need to wait till people like get. There needs to be a cultural shift. And at the beginning of the show, they need to put up a sign that says, "I know you like us, and you are fans of the band. But I assure you, if you all sit, you will all be able to see."
Yeah. Amazing. Well, when you run your own concert venue, you can put that sign up and see how it goes.
Fish can make it happen. They have a lot of control, cultural control over their audience. They just need to put that message out there, and people will get on board.
Oh my God. Anyway, so. Sitting down was actually a really nice experience because you would feel much more of the bass sitting down. So it was, you know, getting like a nice butt massage from the music. And also then, you know, you could watch the screens. And so this was actually really nice. Like, you know, if you just, again, like if you want to take a break or something, like normally most concerts you sit down, you can't see anything anymore. The lights are blocked. The band is blocked. Like you can just see somebody's butt. And in this case, like that, it was much better than that. So that's great. They have... The haptic seating is not just like a speaker that is just playing normal volume. Each of the two concerts, there was one or two moments where it almost seemed like there was an earthquake, like that the entire balcony seemed to shake, and everyone kind of looked around like, did somebody just like drop a whale on this balcony or something? Like it huge like shaking vibration. And eventually, and I looked it up afterwards, and I learned like that's also a feature of their haptic seats. Like they can do like larger moves like that, and it feels pretty nuts. So it was a really fun experience, even just like the seat situation, because there's all these like physical features of it and physical realities of being in this big video dome. That was really nice. I will say the value of good seats is very high here. Like. You really want to be relatively centered in the venue. I was on the first balcony, the 206 section. I gather these are very good seats because, first of all, they were very good seats. But second of all, a few rows down, the people behind me pointed out was seated Trey Anastasio's dad. So I figured,
whoa,
if he was put there, that's a pretty good sign. These are good seats. That's the guys behind me were saying, like, oh, I guess these are pretty good seats. I also, like, in the little vestibule, like, to go down into this section, I ran into Peter Ansbach, a member of Goose, and met him. So I think
did you introduce yourself? Or well,
very
like, say
quickly.
Hi or
I just said, I did the Merlin. Oh, I really, really enjoy your work. And I just, everybody was trying to take pictures with him. And so I just breezed through pretty quickly because I didn't want to, like, be that guy. So I figure if Trey's dad and a member of Goose were seated in this section, I guess it's a pretty desirable section. But so I would strongly suggest. I'll get to that in a second. But back to the show. So obviously, as a Fish fan, the music was fantastic. They were very well rehearsed. It was very well produced. The visuals were great. I didn't quite know what to expect. Like, what are they going to do with the screens? I believe I speculated last week, like, it might be kind of like an iTunes visualizer or something. And there were certain, like, every song they had a different thing going on with the screens. Certain songs were kind of like visualizers. Some of them were, like, basically composited live video effects of the band playing. So they had cameras on the band, like, on each member of the band, and they would, like, you know, have some kind of visual effect, like photo booth, like, you know, have some kind of visual effect that's processing their live video and then throw it up on the screens, like in a big grid, like, you know, Brady Bunch style, or like some kind of video, like color shifting and shadow playing and edge finding, like, you know, so they had like live video of the band playing, but processed. They also had some that were like pre-rendered scenes or effects, you know, just kind of like animations almost. And then some were kind of tweaked live. And there have been a few articles about this where they apparently, The Verge had an article about this, they actually used Unreal Engine to actually generate like live manipulating animations that the director could control based on what the band was doing. Because that's the thing, like with Fish, like they're a jam band. Like they don't, like when you know when U2 was in this venue, U2 had they composed a complete show with predefined, like, at this point we're going to play this song and that we're going to have this visual and it's going to roughly work like this and then we're going to go to this next thing. Phish preset the set list, but there are certain songs they jam in and they kind of do what they feel like, and so they designed the visuals of those songs to be able to go on for any amount of time and to be able to be tweaked and like kind of manually commanded by the visual director as things went through. So that was just like, just technically speaking, like that's a pretty impressive accomplishment when you're dealing with like live manipulation of these random visuals that are being rendered by Unreal Engine onto a 16K square circular projection. Like it was quite a technical accomplishment. And then just like content wise, you know, Phish usually has a really great light show. Like they have a guy, Chris Kuroda, who's like this famous lighting director. He's really well regarded, and he's done all their lights forever. And they usually put on a really good light show, and it's great. But as soon as you see this, you're like, oh my god, this is so much better than a light show. Like having all of this video content, it's remarkable. Like they did this one. This is the only one I'll call out specifically because I know we're running long, but one of their songs, Pillow Jets, it's a recent song. It's not very well liked by the fans. It's kind of a slower, maybe a little bit boring song. And so when that song started, they had like this like forest that you're like slowly moving through, almost like an Apple TV landscape screensaver. You're like slowly moving forward in this like CGI forest. And that song comes on, and a bunch of fans kind of are like, oh, well, I guess this is a good time to go to the bathroom. So all the people, the whole row in front of me got up and left during that song. And this song proceeded to slowly, like, it was, you're going through this forest, and then the colors start shifting on the trees. And then they get a little bit brighter colored. And then things start moving. And then, like, over the course of this, like, 10-minute-long song, the trees slowly start becoming fireworks of color, and like the colors are exploding out of each of the leaves of the trees. And I'm like, and this is a good time for me to clarify, I was completely sober and on no drugs whatsoever for this show.
I was about to ask, I was trying to figure out how to interrupt and ask that question delicately. So I'm glad you've already answered it for me.
Yeah. So I was a little bit sick. I had like a cold, and so I didn't have anything else in my system except, it was funny, like, you know, I on the way in, like, I, you know, the security guy is like, you know, what's in your pocket, and I take out a bag of Fisherman's Friend. Like, I'm probably the only person here who brings in a bag of cough drops to a Phish concert that are actually just cough drops. Anyway, so I'm there totally sober, and this ridiculous like mushroom trip color explosion is happening on the screens, and I felt high. Like, it was that immersive. I'm like, I don't need to do any drugs to feel this feeling. Like, this is amazing. And it's just, it shows, like, the incredible immersion. And of course, some of this is just, I'd say a large part of this is that Phish themselves and their visual staff did a really good job with it. Like, this is a canvas. Bands can use it in different ways. There's going to be bands that do it worse and better. Phish does a really good job with this stuff, and this was no exception. They did an amazing job. And yeah, the Pillow Jets tree firework explosion mushroom trip was definitely my favorite song. and I had the clear view because everyone in front of me got up and left, and like they came back afterwards, and I was just thinking, like, you guys have no idea what you just missed. But anyway, so they did such a fantastic job. It was great, and it really, like, it is so much elevated above a regular concert experience. The ability to do this well, because it is such a production, will be mostly limited to really big, really profitable bands. So you're not going to see like indie bands here. And part of that's good because, like, this is very different from the experience of seeing a band in most venues. Because in most venues, you are looking at the band, you are watching them play, and maybe looking a little bit at the lights. With this, the band could have not even been there. Like, because what you're watching,
oh, that's
is
wild.
You're watching the entire sky above them. So you're not really looking down at the band very much at all. That's gonna affect, obviously, like, what kind of act you'd want to see in a place like this. But with that disclaimer aside, and with the obvious disclaimer that, like, only the biggest acts will be able to afford to produce a show like this with all these visuals and everything like that, with those disclaimers aside, I strongly encourage you all out there, if you ever get a chance to see anything at the Sphere, go see it. If you are in Vegas for whatever reason, and there's a band playing there, and you can get reasonable tickets that are somewhat centrally located in the venue, go. Even if it is not a band that you would otherwise love, it is quite an experience. Now, if you can get a band you love, that's, of course, way better. But it is so unique and is so immersive and so, frankly, mind-blowing. Go see anything there. Like, whatever is playing that you can get into next time you find a way to get to Vegas, or if you happen to be there for other reasons, go. Trust me. Go see anything there. It is that much of a good experience.
And Apple recorded the whole thing, and it'll be released on Vision Pro soon, right?
So, and that's the thing. Like, can you imagine? The whole time, I'm thinking, like, this is the perfect advertisement for VR headsets, sort of. See, the thing is, like, so as I was thinking, like, man, I would love if there could be, like, a VR headset version of this. Like, I would love if they just, like, put Apple's, like, Alicia Keys cameras, like, put those in the balcony that I was sitting in and just sell me a live stream of a fixed camera from that perspective that I can just, you know, look up and down whenever I want to, look all around
me. That's such fish thinking. No, what you want is the direct feed of that 16K by 16K video mapped onto a Sphere inside Vision Pro. You don't need to send it through the analog hole and then get it back in through cameras. No, go direct. Just get the video.
But here's the thing. So I thought about that. Like, obviously, you're right. That would be an option. But, like, there was one song, they played a song called Ghost in the first night I was there, where the visual was these giant, they looked like giant robots made of high-voltage power line towers, like those giant towers that hold the high-voltage power lines, you know? They were, like, giant robots made of those. And first of all, like, and just against just flat black, like straight black backdrop, and these giant robots that were standing above you made of power lines. And because, again, like, because the screens are so far from you, you can't tell that these are being rendered right up, you know, relatively close to you. And so it looked like you were actually standing below these giant hundreds of feet tall, you know, power line robots that were angry. And then at one point, the one that was directly above you leaned forward, and it looked like it was going to fall on the entire audience. And everyone freaked out. Like, ah! And because part of the experience of being in a place like this is the people around you. It is you're experiencing this together with the audience of other extremely high people around you. And if a Vision Pro, or, you know, it, like, if a VR headset version of this was just transmitting the feed of video in that's being mapped on the screens, and you were sitting in an empty movie theater kind of thing, like what they have with some of the experiences now, I think it would feel, like many people complain about the Vision Pro, it would feel very lonely, because it's like, oh, I'm in the middle of this concert arena and no one else is here with me. Like, part of the experience of being in a place like this is feeling what everyone else is feeling and capturing, like, what makes everyone else excited, you know? So I think for this to succeed, if this was ever to succeed in a VR content play, it would need to be, ideally, it would need to be, like, a live recording of, like, from a perspective of a good seat in the audience.
Why wouldn't you just want to be in it with 5,000 other people who also have Vision Pros on? You know what I mean? Like, that's the VR presence thing, the whole personas thing. What if you were in a theater where every single seat was filled with a persona?
I think that would be really weird and creepy. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just too new to the VR world. Like, I'm still kind of down.
I mean, obviously,
those,
it's not going to be as high fidelity as actual humans, and probably not as high fidelity right now as a recording of actual humans. But I feel like the goal is, hey, instead of me just putting on this thing and me being alone in this giant sphere, it's me and the 5,000 other people who are all doing it all instanced together in this one thing, and I can hear them, you know, ooh and ah when the big robot leans forward and stuff like that. We're not there yet, to be clear, but I feel like that is attainable with not so distant technology.
Maybe. I mean, we'll see. But I think it would be tempting to make it too technically perfect by doing things like just sending you the video stream and mapping it in 3D and everything. It's tempting to do that and down and undervalue the human element and the value of the human element. I think that would be a mistake. I think ultimately the human element is very much a part of the experience of being there, and you really, anything that's going to succeed and give you anything close to the experience you want needs that. It needs the human element. So, you know, I think there is potential opportunity for a VR content play here. I would definitely buy it if I could, for many great concerts and live events. That would be wonderful. But it would have to capture the people too. Even like honestly, live sporting events too. I mean, the people would be there anyway, so I guess you'd capture them regardless. But like when you're at a live sporting event, a huge part of the fun of being there is being in the crowd with the other people in the crowd and reacting with them and feeling and hearing their reactions to everything. That's part of the fun of being at a live event.
I know, that's what VR is trying to do with the whole presence thing. I feel like my friend is sitting next to me on the couch as we're watching it together. I feel like I'm in a stadium with 10,000 people, but it's 10,000 personas. You know, like that's, I know that we're not there yet, but that's the whole idea, is that the humans are providing that content. They're providing the movement, the sound, the oohs and the ahs, the jostling, the looking to the side and seeing expressions on your friend's face. Like that's, I feel like that's where it, the experience that is sold by a lot of the VR stuff. And, you know, it, with the personas that Casey got to try with Mike or whatever, like it's obviously not there yet, but it is actually, there's a tiny glimmer of that human element that you're talking about, even in the very primitive, even playing Battleship with shells of yourself that aren't even visible from the back.
There is, and I think, you know, there is definitely a place for that. There is value for that. But I think that's never going to replace or even compete with the value of, like, actual humans being there if that is an option available. So, like, obviously, not every context that's an option. Like, that isn't always a possibility. But when that is a possibility, like if you're trying to do some kind of live event as content, like, I think you want the live people there in some context. Now, obviously, you can do things to like reduce their annoyingness. Like you wouldn't seat the camera so low that when the people in front of you stand up, they block it. You know,
I was going to say like this type of thing is ideal for things like the Vision Pro because you do actually have a stationary camera, right?
Yeah.
It's like you don't get up and go to the camera doesn't get up and go to the bathroom, so you don't have any of the problems of like motion sickness and changing perspective and cutting for, you could do that, but they shouldn't. They should just, even more so than sporting events, because in a concert venue like this, there is one pretty much best seat in the house, which you are apparently very close to, whereas in a sporting event, the field is so big that sometimes you do want like a close-up on the goal or, you know, or different perspectives, but this show is made to be viewed from an audience, so you can just pick that ideal seat, plant the camera or virtual camera there and just keep it there the whole time.
Yeah, and I think it can already be part of like the whole, like there's like a bit, right, like only a few rows behind me was like the big like sound and video booth kind of thing, like the big like sound and video mixing board setup and everything. That's the perfect place. Put it there. Like have it be part of that. Done.
I think there's something to be said, like Marco was saying a moment ago. I mean, I don't get to go to concerts often, but it is one of my favorite things to do is go to see, you know, music live. And I really think that part of what makes that so fun is that shared group experience, is knowing even for a band like Phish, where it's so easy to get your hands on a copy of the show, it's still amazing knowing that you're seeing art being created live right in front of your eyes. And to a degree, the people, the thousands, the hundreds, the thousands, the tens of thousands of people that are next to you are the only ones that will ever really and truly get the full version of that experience. And even a perfectly constructed Vision Pro version of that experience, immersive experience, it's still, in my eyes, not exactly the same as being there. Now, does that mean it doesn't have merit? Of course not. I think it would be amazing to be able to go on tour with Dave Matthews Band or Phish or who have you without having to leave your house. Like that would be incredible. But it will never replace the real deal, you know, and there's room in the world for both of these things. And I would love for both of these things to exist, but you can pry a real honest to goodness concert from my cold dead hands.
I wonder what's more expensive, flying to Las Vegas and seeing a real Sphere show or buying an Apple Vision Pro.
No comment. I'm not even the one who spent the money, and I'm still saying no comment.
Yeah, like the VR version of this is obviously that we're projecting into a future where it is much less expensive to do this from your home, and far more people can do it than, because I think, I don't know how many spheres they're planning on making. There are plans for a bunch of other ones in other places, but like, if people could do this from their own home, it's like they're seeing TV in a movie theater or seeing live sports versus seeing sports on TV. Seeing sports on TV is not the same as seeing live sports, but it is way more accessible to way more people, and it's way less expensive and way more convenient. And it does actually have some advantages over seeing sports live in terms of perspective changes and instant replay and stuff. So, yeah, I think there's definitely a place for both of these things. I don't think the sphere is going to be obsolete anytime soon, because big, impressive screens are always big and impressive. And by the way, this is why people are so excited about micro-LED TVs, because this is just a big micro-LED TV. But yeah, the problem with micro-LED TVs is to make the LEDs small enough and close enough together. That's why like the micro-LED TVs are always so big. Like, it used to be the smallest one you could get was like 100 inches. They recently, at CES, they had one that was 77 inches, and people were like, oh my God, 77 inches! Like, people were excited that it was so small, which is like the opposite of what everyone's been thinking about televisions for the entire history of television. It's because they want this tech to be get to the point where they can jam all those little tiny lights into a normal sized television set that doesn't cost as much as a car. Unfortunately, they still cost tens of thousands of dollars. But yeah, this, they don't have a space problem. So, but that's what it is. Individual tiny LEDs, and they can be really bright, and they look really good as long as you're far enough away from them.
Couple of quick thoughts. First of all, if you haven't seen Drew Carey's review of his experience, the Sphere, it is something, and it is worth watching. It is not really kid friendly, but quite funny. And
let's just say he enjoyed his experience.
He very much enjoyed
his
experience.
Drops.
he had a lot of cough drops. And then, secondly, somebody had suggested this to me a while back. I don't have the faintest memory who it was, and I apologize. But there's a Vision Pro app called Amaze VR, and I will put a link in the show notes. It is ostensibly a like music kind of sort of concert app where you can download these immersive, I'm going to say concerts, but that's a stretch. And you can watch them, and they have Megan Thee Stallion, T-Pain, Avenged Sevenfold, and there's a free one that is Zara Larsson, who I think I recognize the song that she played. Let me tell you, I have an experience with getting real old that maybe we can talk about another time, but I feel older and older every passing day. But anyways,
I mean, that is how time works.
In terms of like, I feel like an old man now. But anyways, these are concerts-ish. It's more like, you know, let me drop an actual artist in like a completely CGI environment, and it is immersive, but it's not a concert in the way that you and I think of concerts. Nevertheless, it is worth checking out and downloading the free one just to see what sorts of things are possible. And you know, there's not that much else to do with Vision Pro right now, so why not do that? So we'll put a link in the show notes. But it is funny because the Zara Larsson one, she does like a song on the free version, and there's at one point where she is at eye level and gets like right up to the camera, way closer than I saw Alicia Keys get. And it was like kind of uncomfortable and off-putting. Like, it felt like she was looking deep into your eyes in like a not comfortable way. I don't know. Maybe I'm just,
that's kind of how I felt with the, with the Highline video. Like, it starts out and you're extremely close to the woman's face and you're like, I feel like I'm a creep. Like, I don't want to be like, I don't know this person. She doesn't know me. I feel like I should not be standing this close to her.
The difference, though, is that in this case, Zara Larsson is like looking into the camera, whereas I forget the woman's name, but from the Highline thing, she was kind of looking past the camera. But this is like, I'm staring into your soul. So this scenario is very, very uncomfortable. But anyway, it is worth checking out despite all that, just to see what's possible. So you should take a look.
Yeah, because like, again, like I think, like I was obviously, you know, I was there, and then when I, you know, after I was there, I looked up some videos of, first of all, like what they had done like the nights before I was there, because I missed the first two nights. I kind of regret honestly not going to all four, but I had no way to know they would be this good. But anyway, so I looked up some stuff I hadn't seen, and then I also looked up some videos of parts of the concerts that I did attend, just to kind of see, like, you know, how was I remembering it right, and I kind of wanted to try to relive some of it. And even the really good videos do not feel like what it felt like to be there. it is really, like, videos cannot capture this. And this, again, this is what everyone says about VR experiences, too, because a small video cannot possibly capture a 360-degree or 180-degree in front of you kind of experience. Like, it is way better to experience it in person or, for things that don't exist in person, in 3D. Like, that is way better. So this is a huge opportunity. Like, this is a demo to show everyone, like, oh, this is why VR could be really cool. But if anything, going to the Sphere suggests, like, yeah, but everyone in here is seeing way better quality video than any VR headset can offer today. It's hearing way better quality audio with, I would point out, a subwoofer, which currently is not super practical or easily possible with VR headsets. And you get the communal experiences. And so, if anything, this shows, like, VR has promise if these deals can be made, but nothing beats the real thing. And, man, is this a crazy real thing to experience. Like, again, go see anything in that venue. If you happen to like it, that's even better. But go see anything in that venue. It is quite an experience. I strongly recommend it.
I like how you're calling a gigantic array of LEDs the real thing. The real thing is Red Rocks, Marco. The real world, the real sky, the real mountains.
I mean, Fish plays there a lot, but, like, they can't make a space vortex above them when they do.
Well, you know, what if there was a real space vortex? Could happen.
If it was ever going to happen, it would happen above a Fish concert.
Yeah, it would happen above the show at Red Rocks, probably. Yeah,
yeah, probably.
Or at least people will report it, having seen it.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that happens a lot.
Oh, my.
All right, that's a good ending for that.
Can do some titles.
A self-smushed I suggested, but it's pretty good.
The other thing to think about, like, and I'm not going to put this in the show, but I was thinking, like, what incentive would the bands have to make this content available to VR headsets? Like, wouldn't they want people to just come to the shows?
I mean, I would think they would do it for money, and I think people would still show up to the shows. Same way that people buy the music, but still show up to the shows. Like, I think it'll...
I guess that's true.
There's definitely an economic slot for that to go into. Because as you noted, it's not as impressive as being there, right? So I think, and, you know, and they could sell a lot more. They can only sell so many tickets to that arena, right?
Yeah.
But they could potentially sell all the Fish fans who couldn't show up there, they'd buy it. So, are you really losing money from them? Because those people see that, they're going to want to go there even more.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. And plus, like, because they already do live video streaming. But that's with regular cameras throughout the venue, they switch between, like, a live production, and they charge that, it's video on demand. They charge something like $30 for that on demand viewing of that. They could easily charge $100 for the VR version. People would buy it. Like, it's that good, or it could be that good.
I thought that was a good robots one. I see the giant robots made of those.
Angry Powerline robots.
Everyone heard the same nonsense. I think that's the one I like.
Do we want to do an after show title? Is it worth it?
Yeah, no, for sure.
All right.
Which one did you say you liked?
Everyone heard the same nonsense. Because it's it fits for the whole episode, especially with the technical difficulties of the boot.
That's true. Yeah, we got to go with it.
And I think the after show was significant, so yeah. Right. And technically.
By the way, I am going to cut all of the Casey disconnection stuff. Like, that's not...
Yeah,
that's
I know.
Not gonna
be
yes, please.
Show, yeah. But not from the bootleg.
Nothing to me, like, one of my, like, podcasting pet peeves is, like, nothing is less interesting as a listener as hearing about your technical problems recording your podcast. Like, I never, like, if you have, like, issues with Zoom or Skype or whatever, like, I never want to hear about that as a listener.
Unless you're on the bootleg, in which case it's gold.
I mean, if you're on the bootleg, like, that's the reality. Like, you have to hear about that. But, like, in an edited, posted show, like... I should never hear about your technical problems ever, ever, ever.
All right. Everyone heard the same nonsense.
Cool. Which
is good. It's in the robot.
That is good for the bootleg, especially for this one.
That's a gift for you, bootleggers. And genuinely, I'm really, really sorry that was such a mess. I really, really am. I am deeply embarrassed, and that was way unprofessional. Even though it wasn't on purpose, I'm embarrassed, and it was unprofessional. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Should happen. All right. So we will cut off the live people now. Thank you for being live people. And we will talk to you next week.